Beth, we can hear you. All lines are muted at this point, though.
Oh, that's right. Okay, thank you. Little details I forget. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and start our breakout session. This is the clinical data analytics section. If that was not what you signed up for, or if that's not what you transferred in for, into rather, let me know, and we can send you to the correct room, but we would love to have you. So my name is Beth Franklin, as I said, and welcome to everybody. I hope those of you who were here this morning or were on the line with us this morning enjoyed our two keynote speakers, and so we're going to continue with some of the momentum that they have hopefully generated. I just want to start by saying we have a very big group. We've been having daily statistics updates, if you will, and this number kept growing, which is great. I believe we have about 17 people online, and at least that was the count, and there should be approximately 30 to 35 in here, although it looks like a little less. But regardless, we do have a large group, which does pose some of the challenges for us, but I think if we can have the folks online, when you have a question, just go ahead and put the question into the chat, and we will go ahead and actually, it's muted. The phone line's muted, yeah. And so maybe after the Sarah is our operator. Sarah, after we get through the presentations, maybe we can if you could unmute the phones, but people can also chat with us online.
Certainly.
So the first thing I need to do, though, is I do need to do a roll of who is here. So I'm just going to go through names, which might be a little bit easier. Is there Avanti Anil? No. Don, or I'm sorry, Anil Avanti. Don, okay. Guillermo, is there somebody named Guillermo here? No, okay. Dana Alexander, I know she's here. Kathleen Aller. Okay. Hey, Sarah, can you unmute the phone? Because I think I know some of these folks will be on the web. Nicole. Is there Nicole Antonson? Antonson? No. Let's see. Sarah, do you have the web open, the phone open?
The phone lines are open.
Okay, great. Because I'm getting to some web people here. Jason Aronovitz? No. Nina Aora, no. Aida, I saw her out in the hall. Cynthia Barton, Karen Beal, Kristen Beetson, no. Robert Bell, Jennifer Bertich, no. Carol Bickford, I know she is not here. Chris Bontempi. Heidi here? Did I hear Chris say yes? Okay. Is Heidi here? Heidi Bosley? Okay. Laurel Borkowski? Borowski, rather? I should know that I'm Bukowski. Laurel, are you on the phone? Nope. Mary Brahman? I saw Mary earlier, I thought. Okay. Dwight Brown? Nope. Oh, you know what? I'm not looking at the right list here. No wonder nobody's answering me. Can I borrow your list here? Thank you. Okay, let's start over. They gave me too many lists. Okay, so Dawn said she was here. Okay, Girma? Nope. Dana is here. Kathleen Aller, she did not respond. Kathleen, okay. Tara Barnes? Yep, you're here. Okay. Sharon Beal? As you can see, a lot of these names I already called because there's so many people in this room. Okay, Sharon Beal, Karen Carol, I know, is not here. Laurel? No. Sherry? Okay. Kathleen Charters? No. Imran? Okay. Chi? Yep, great. Jennifer Kovich? No. Patty Craig? She was on the call earlier, I know. Mark Denty? No. Mindy Dobkin? Okay, great. David Doman? Nope. Maria Feaster? Nope. Mary Fermazin? Nope. Joe Francis? Yep, I saw him before. Ron Freyberg. Jeff Garner. Yemin Emain. Sharon Wilson. You're online, okay. Linda Groh. Okay, great. Cecilia Hahn. Okay, great. Elisa Hardy.
Present.
Okay, great, thanks. Teresa Hart. Rachel Hasselbeck. Carla Hares.
Yes.
Lisa Harrington. Patrice Holtz. Oh, Patrice is over there in the corner. Okay, hold on. Let me go back to Sharon. Okay. Who was I? Patrice. Okay, Louise. Brother. They even have glasses on. I can't read. Gerard. Okay. Sean Loftus. Melissa Manning. Mary McCall. Okay. Karen Nielsen, she's here. Ted's here. Gregory Paulson. Kim Schwartz. Jill Shelley. Okay. Marcia, I know, is here. Chris is here. John Song.
Yes.
Great. Cindy Sunderman, rather. Oh. I know Mary's here. Donna Thompson. Great. Sarah Tone. Okay. Charlene Underwood. Okay, that's fine. Leslie Van Perries. Louise Webb. And Stephen Wright. Is there anybody here in the room or on the phone that I did not call?
Hi, this is John White from AHRQ.
Okay, great. Thanks, John. Anyone else?
This is Sherry Campion. I think you called me, but I didn't catch it.
Yeah, we see you online, so thanks. And I'm sorry. Anyone else that I missed? Okay. Okay, so much for roll call. Let's get to the heart of what we need to talk about today. So we have four track leaders, Dana Alexander, Karen Nielsen, Ted, okay, you set an order. Ted Palin, how orderly we are, and Chris Snyder. And we'll have them all introduce themselves in a minute, so let me just go through a couple of housekeeping things here. Just pretty much, again, an overview of who we are. And by the way, everyone should be able to see either the TV on my left or the projector in the front, or you're online. So what is the eMeasure Learning Collaborative? This started back in the fall. We were publicly initiative convened by NQF to promote sharing and learning across key eMeasure stakeholders and to advance knowledges and best practices. The project consists of some interactive webinars. We've had two already. And in-person meetings. This is the first of the two in-person meetings. We will have a second one in August, on August 9th, and they are spearheaded by the collaborative members. So, again, the four people that I introduced a moment ago have been very involved in putting this particular breakout together, and I think you're going to find it very interesting, inspiring, and hopefully we'll come up with the questions or answers to some of our questions. So this is a HHS deliverable for us, and we have four things that we need to provide to HHS in October. One is to identify some best practices. So what are some repeatable models that are actually working? To identify some gap areas for eMeasures, these deliverables are across all five breakouts, just to let you know it's not just us. And then to develop recommendations for the future. So specifically, there are really four questions that we're going to answer. Actually, this group will answer the first three. The fourth one on this is for one of the other groups. So again, we need to look at what are best practice examples, what are the mechanisms to enhance the workflow data, and what are the recommendations. A little bit about how this is going to all work. I'm going to turn this over to Karen Nielsen. She's going to moderate and facilitate as we go on. At about noonish, we are going to break for lunch. If you ordered, we are not providing lunch. There is no free lunch with this. If you ordered lunch, Your lunch will be brought in to you, which is one reason why I had to do the roll call. And if you did not order lunch and you would like lunch, you can go outside. There are a number of places around here where you can get a sandwich. Oh, great. So if you want something, we can and we can direct you to places that are quick and places that are slow. And then you can bring them back. When you do come back, you will have to have them wand you back upstairs, if you will, because we are a secure environment here. The second thing is, I don't think they mentioned this, but hopefully you all found the bathrooms. And if for some reason we need to vacate, there are steps right outside the door here. So we're going to work until about 12:15 we'll break, and we'll come back and reconvene. And one of the things we need to provide is some materials, which Karen's going to talk a little bit about, the questions that we need to answer. We are going to need to vacate this room at 2 o'clock so they can magically redo it. and we will reconvene then at 2:30, and we'll go over that later. So let me turn it over to Karen, and if you need something, just let me know. Yes, there are. You can talk. Okay, good. Yes, you can use the mic. The mics that are in front of you. We have how many on the phone are you showing? Okay, so we have 3. That's fine. So we do have people on the phone. We may have some others join us. If you are going to speak, if you could use the microphones in front of you, are they working? Yes, if you push, and I need to step away, and it'll show red, and it means it's on. Okay? All right, and let me know if you need anything. I'm going to give this to you, Karen, so you can control that. And then...
Testing? Ah, much better. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you, everybody, for being here, and especially those on the line. I can say on behalf of the 4 of us, it's been an exciting ride. To be quite honest, we've spent a lot of time on the phone together, and this is the first time we've gotten to see each other face-to-face, so this is really quite fun on many levels for us. I'll let each one of us go through and introduce ourselves. You're going to see there's some diverse backgrounds here, which is really exciting because it also represents those of you who have actually come to participate today. So 3 cheers to HHS for making the money available for this. It's really exciting. So try it again. Okay. So this is the trick. If you lose your mic, turn it off and turn it on again. Okay, with that, what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to start with the introductions with Dana, and we'll just kind of go down the table here.
Well, good morning, everyone. So I'm Dana Alexander, and I'm the Vice President of Integrated Care Delivery and Chief Nursing Officer with GE Healthcare. Very engaged with NQF over the past few years. On various projects and committees, such as this, the e-collaborative, also an appointed position on the care coordination committee. So my area of interest with all of this, or I should say what I've really, I think I've come to clearly understand as we're pursuing e-measures, is that whether developer, vendor, or provider, we truly are all in this together. And it needs to be a collaborative effort. And while we have the QDM and the measuring authoring tool that I think is providing some good framework and tools for us, is that there's still a lot of work to be done, and hence why we are here today. A particular area of interest of mine, and I'm sure many of you, are those measures that are really achieving measuring outcomes and are cross-cutting, such as with care coordination. And I think that for all of us is really going to truly be a focus for the future, and where data analytics and some of the discussion that we're having today is really going to be a really driving force. Thank you.
Thanks, Dana. Okay, hello again. My name is Karen Nielsen. Now, I've got a vendor hat on today, but I actually have to admit it's actually a new hat. I've only been with Siemens for 6 months, and I have a public health background. And I had the pleasure several years ago of actually being a CMS contractor, supporting the maintenance and development of clinical quality measures. So I represent an interesting paradigm, I think you could say, right? Because I know there's people on the phone. Hello to all of you in the QIO world. Some of them I had the pleasure of actually working with in the past, so I'm really excited to be in a meeting with the quality improvement organizations represented. You know, this is a huge transition for all of us. And at Siemens, I'm actually in the R&D side. So I'm in the business intelligence analytics side of the world. And we're trying to obviously look at new ways of supporting all of these initiatives that all of you are also trying to deal with, right? How do we make this transition from chart abstraction over to the e-measure world? And for the measure developers, it's an amazing journey, I have to admit. So hats off to everybody for being here, and I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to my next colleague.
Hi, this is Ted Pauline, and I am an internist with Kaiser Permanente in Colorado. I wear several hats there. I am a practicing internist, so I still see patients in the ambulatory environment. I am also involved in our Institute for Health Research, focusing on informatics research, examples of projects that I'm focused on in informatics is the use of email communications between the patient and providers. How does that affect utilization of services? Virtual care. So how does telemonitoring, telehealth, telemedicine, e-consults, how does that all fit into this new paradigm of care delivery in the 21st century? So those are some of my research interests. But I also wear the hat of physician manager for clinical reporting, a long title that really involves what we're talking about today. How do we use the data to analyze it and then understand how it can be applied to better care delivery processes with the ultimate goal of better patient outcomes. So that's me in a nutshell, I guess.
And I'm Chris Snyder. I'm a hospitalist. I actually been practicing in Salisbury, Maryland, which is about 200 miles east of here. You fall in the ocean if you go past us. So I grew up in this community, so I've been in the D.C. area in Montgomery County. I started in primary care for a few years, and then I got into hospital medicine where I met Donna Thompson, who's sitting next to me here. She's the director of our performance improvement department. I kind of brought her with us because she's a big part of the story. She and I have a partnership to hopefully improve care in our community in Salisbury, Maryland, which is rural Maryland. Salisbury serves three states. It's a very common regional non-for-profit hospital, almost 400 beds. We do about 90,000 ER visits a year. I still actively practice medicine. So I guess I would be the one, as far as I would say, is the frontline guy, still living the dream of practicing medicine, trying to get through all these wonderful barriers we have and help my providers utilize our CPOE, which is where I started my journey with IT about 10 years ago. We are a McKesson shop, so we utilize all McKesson services, and we're actually level 6 HIMSS hospital, which is for a regional trauma center. It's a pretty big accomplishment. So we have integration, we have utilization, and my goal has been to take that to the next level and not only make it utilization, but give it to the providers to make it a tool that actually helps them be better practitioners, whether it's the environmental folks cleaning beds or whether it's the physician pushing a presser agent in the ICU, or our VisiCue product where we have doctors doing telemedicine from Christiana Hospital in Wilmington, Delaware, managing our folks for us because we don't have enough doctors in our community. So kind of a real-life story. The journey I hope to take you guys down is to show you some of our frustrations, I think, with the data, and I really am excited about the hopefully the collaboration that we'll have here. We work very closely with our vendor, been a development partner, and I am all for vendor relations, but I'm also for making it better for the patient first, and obviously that's my focus, and then the providers also. So I've lived through a lot of frustrations rolling out a very sophisticated system, and now we're trying to improve things. Last year we saved 130 lives in our severe sepsis campaign, which was driven by a solution using our CPOE and our lab integration. So we're doing magical things, but we need to make this a national event, not a local event. So that's where I stand. Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you. Okay, with that, can we test to make sure that our folks on the web can hear us and can participate. Hi, everybody out there. And could we just do a vocal check? Can you let us know if, can somebody speak into their microphone and let us know if we can test this out and hear you?
This is John White. I'm not on the web itself. I mean, I've got the WebEx up, but I'm using a phone line as well.
And how is the WebEx functioning for you right now?
Pretty good.
Outstanding. Okay, that's great news. Anybody else out there? Okay, now, this is going to, our challenge is to make sure that everybody feels part of this meeting. And so this is going to be a challenge for you. So if you want to talk, please barge in, okay, because there's no way we can really hear you otherwise, and we can't see you raise your hand. I don't think there's a hand-raising capability, is there? Star one. Okay. Pardon? I think that would be great if we could leave the... Yeah, I think that would be fabulous. And then obviously if there's any background noise that we're starting to hear, we'll let you know. But I think that way this will encourage open dialogue, which is what today is all about. Now,
just to confirm really quickly, operator, if you could make sure all of the lines are unmuted on the phone so that they can participate freely throughout the breakout session today.
Thank you for that. Okay, so let me define facilitator as far as today's meeting is concerned. Really, this is going to be a very, very informal facilitation because the four of us bring very distinct backgrounds to this. And as a result, the four of us will be thinking about different questions and different ways to look at how these objectives need to be achieved today, okay? So the idea is, how do we go ahead and share the best practices, garner some good input, brainstorm? Now, there could be some issues as far as we're not going to be able to solve today because maybe we just don't have the right players in the room, and that's fine. We're going to be meeting again in August, so more to come on that, but there'll be more opportunities to interact and to share ideas. We've already discussed the timeline today. Why don't we go ahead and move on to Dr. Palin?
So I'm trying to decide how I should sit so I can see everything. Actually, I'm going to look through that way.
There you go. Oh, what a great idea.
So this is Ted again, and as I said, I'm from Colorado Permanente Medical Group, which is the medical, the physician arm of Kaiser Permanente in Colorado. And I'm going to present some of the ways that we are interacting not only with the EMR, but then the data that comes out of the EMR to understand how we can use the data. Now, the examples I'm giving obviously are Kaiser specific examples, but what I'd like to glean or have you generate the discussion basically from these slides is that here's examples of how data could be used, and I want to highlight some of the intricacies or non-straightforward ways that this data comes about and how can we improve this as we move forward in understanding how to develop e-metrics. So I'm going to talk a little bit about registries, clinical practice of it, how we use data in transitions of care, patient outcomes data that really was where we want to get to. So those are some of the goals of what I want to show you here. As a background, Kaiser was founded right after World War II by Henry J. Kaiser. Kaiser operates in 8 regions. We have about 9 million members nationwide. In Colorado, we have about 900 physicians. We have about a little over, well, almost 550,000 members in the Colorado region of Kaiser. The IHR, which I'm also part of, along with being a practicing internist, I'm also, as I said previously, Institute of Health Research, where we conduct translational research. The idea is to translate research into practice. So that's where some of this comes from as far as understanding how informatics can be translated into practice. That gives you a little background. We kind of talked about this a little bit, but again, to frame the discussion is, you know, there's several ways that data can be used, and inpatient, outpatient. I'm going to be talking about the outpatient. Chris Snyder will be talking more on the inpatient idea. And in both cases, it can be at the individual patient level, what we normally call the point of care, point of service model of the use of measuring, and how does that apply? There's also the, what Farzad talked about earlier, is there's also the population management phase of this. And so there's what defines a disease registry? How do you define disease state registries? How do you define the prevention measures that would go into prevention registries? There's also transitions of care. So that involves both population management, and it involves individual patient management as we have patients moving from home to clinic to hospital to SNF back to their home. How is that all coordinated? Again, e-measures are a big part of this. So where and why do we use e-measures? I just said transitions of care, the care coordination during the transitions of care. Complex chronic care issues. You know, we can have a disease registry for diabetics, but diabetics just don't have diabetes. You know, they might have congestive heart failure, renal disease, wound issues with non-healing foot ulcers, etc. So it becomes a complex disease registry that has to cross walk across several registries, and how do you take care of that? Again, mining the data and having consolidated e-measures. Medication reconciliation obviously involves understanding how to use the data on the back end to help with so we reduce adverse drug reactions, multiple meds that may be the same med because it hasn't been reconciled. Support of this patient-centered home medical home idea, all of this about the using accountable care organizations to deal with the patient, but also the patient-centric level of this, patient-reported outcomes. How do we do e-measuring on that? I think Farzad pointed that out, too. We have to have the patient at the center of here. And little that we're just starting into that road of how do we standardize patient-reported outcomes. Virtual data warehouse. This becomes how do you structure data so that it can the interoperability type thing. So you can have your own data warehouse for your own institution, but when we start looking at transitions of care, patients moving from one area of the country to the other, using established e-measures to do population management across not just a region but across the nation, now we have this idea of how does that become a virtual care using virtual data warehouse in this case. Health information exchanges. We're an Epic shop in Colorado. Well, all of Kaiser uses the Epic systems, EMR. They have one system in Epic called Care Everywhere, so you can share from one Epic to another. But if you're not an Epic shop, how does Health Exchange work into that? In Colorado, we have the Colorado Regional Health Information Organization. It's a nonprofit that is in its infancy to establish information exchange. Another example is Vaccine Safety Data Link that Kaiser's part of, the state monitoring immunization. Again, all those are ways to use information exchange. Patient monitoring, I alluded to that a little bit. I'm involved in that, looking at how do you do patient monitoring in all these diverse settings. And the bottom line on all of this, it involves some data standards if we're supposed to be talking in all these diverse areas. So now to get into some examples. So the slide I have is, if you're familiar with Epic, you look at this and you say, wow, that's Epic. Yeah, it is Epic. And I don't want to necessarily say, well, focus on the fact that this is Epic EMR and how quality alerts or safety alerts are generated in Epic. What I want to focus on is that behind the scenes, no matter what system you have, these kind of alerts, or best practice alerts as they're called in Epic, or safety or quality alerts, whatever system you're using, depend on some very principled data standards in the background. So like the first one, it says it's a quality alert. This patient has never had spirometry to confirm the diagnosis of COPD, or you could put / asthma in there. And it's alerting that maybe this person is due for spirometry. Now, this is an example, obviously, point of care service for the patient. But it also exemplifies the fact that, well, how did they know that this alert should come up on this patient? Was the COPD diagnosis correct? Here's the example of the difference between billing codes and really whether the person has COPD. Sometimes they have an acute episode of post-infectious bronchitis. They get coded as COPD. They really don't have COPD, but you get this alert firing. So now if you go between chart review and claims data, you would have a discrepancy here. And that's an example of how do you form metrics so these kind of alerts that fire are really accurate and really you don't end up doing your own chart review at the point of service and say, oh, man, this really doesn't have COPD. This was an acute infectious bronchitis, and it's now resolved. Example of a safety alert saying, well, this patient's on an ACE or an ARB or a diuretic or digoxin, and our system doesn't show that they've had any electrolytes done recently. Maybe their potassium is too high. Maybe their creatinine is too high. Dosing should be altered. Well, behind the scenes on this is, first of all, what standards are you using so that you can pull the data to say, indeed, recognize the person is on a digoxin or an ACE or an ARB? And then what if they got their labs not at Kaiser? And indeed, last week they were at the I think probably a lot of cities have, like in Colorado, it's called the Nine Health Fair. You know, you go to your church or the grocery store and you get your blood tested. Well, should we repeat that test? I'm reading it from a paper, but it's not in the system. The patient brought it into me. I see, oh, their potassium's fine. But it's a piece of paper. It's not in the system. This is an example of how do we work with community resources to define those metrics so that indeed does this become part of the health exchange for the organization and the community? An example there. The other one is a best practice alert to say this person hasn't had screening for cholesterol. You know, again, I just picked three examples of. It's fine if it's in your system, the data, but one, has it been scrubbed appropriately within the system? And two, what if it's not in your system? How does this stuff work? So going on, this is an example of some, again, in the outpatient world at the point of care, or it could be a disease manager or a prevention nurse manager that's looking at. This is a snapshot of a lot of data coalesced on one patient. You can see recent vital sign information. You can see medication list. You can see what we call a gap score. Looking at in the middle column across the top, it's talking about asthma, coronary artery disease, heart failure, chronic kidney disease, diabetes, hypertension, colorectal cancer screening, coronary risk factors, immunization, mammograms, PAP. That's what that stands for across the top. And whether or not they have met certain prevention or disease or whether there's a gap. Again, you could drill down and look at this. But think about the necessity of standards in the background to produce a summary table like this. Now, again, this is not part of Epic. This is a separate tool that we use in Colorado called HealthTrack to try to coalesce data into a summary view. It's kind of like the first stages of doing a manual chart review, only you're doing it electronically. There is a, but what's behind the scenes on this? So if you look at that middle column under the current alerts, think about the algorithm that's needed to understand whether or not an asthmatic has the diagnosis of asthma first. Was it an appropriate diagnosis? Two, are they on an inhaled corticosteroid to control their asthma? So just those two things putting into an algorithm, you have to have standards to know, well, was the asthma diagnosis that's in this problem list of this patient correct in the first place? And number two, where are you pulling the information that they're not on an inhaled corticosteroid? What standard is there? Do you have the relationship with your community pharmacies to get data feeds from them so that you know they're not on an inhaled corticosteroid? So it overlaps so much with what some of the other groups today are talking about of how do you pull this in. So that's just one example of that data point that this person isn't on an inhaled corticosteroid. So, yes, it is a summary electronic abstraction, chart abstraction, but still there's manual effort needed to understand whether the data is accurate or not because we don't a lot of times have the data standards. Going on to the next slide. So we're going here from individual to population disease registries. This is a screenshot of some of our population disease registries in Kaiser and Colorado. So you look at, we have asthma subcategorized, we have heart failure subcategorized, chronic disease, our chronic kidney disease subcategorized, hypertension. And if I drill down into this, the disease manager for these different disease states can look at individual patient level data, which is on the next, oops, I went too far, the next slide here. But again, this is still a lot of manual effort. It presents some information on that is relying on e-measures, but still a lot of measurement or a lot of manual effort to then prompt the person, call the person, bring the person in for added treatment. Could this be improved in order to do this on a population basis? This is just an example of our disease management slides and some of the metrics we follow looking at, well, where do you – This is to really highlight where do you set the parameter of, you know, what's the right level of mammography screening? Is it 80%, 85%, 90%? Again, if you don't have complete data standards, you can't even set the metric of where you want to be because you don't want to know what your numerator or denominator are on these disease states. So again, example of some of those issues. Transitions of care. This is just a screenshot showing how Epic Care works, but what if they're not in an Epic hospital? Where am I getting that data? And again, this is point of view care for an individual patient. How do we do it on a population when they're in a SNF, a urgent care ED, a hospitalization at home, and they're transitioning from all these sites, and how do I get at that data? And this slide is to demonstrate that even though I can look at hospital data on a patient that isn't part of Kaiser but had Epic in their hospital system and I can have care everywhere and see what happened, You know, that CT scan on the left side is free text. You know, somebody dictated it, somebody transcribed it, and somebody made it a PDF file, and now I can view it. How do I capture that data electronically? How do I take a dictated radiology report, define e-metric standards on it, make it discrete data so now it can be used not only at the point of care but in population management? Upper right is looking at EKG, a 12-lead EKG that has been standardized, and I can read it that way, but how many people often read all the individual discrete data points on an EKG? It takes you a lot longer to figure out what the EKG looks like reading discrete data points than the waveform, right? Don't you look at the waveform, Chris? Yeah, you look at the waveform, and in a picture relates a lot of information very quickly. How do you standardize a picture to be able to pull e-metric data out of it? Very interesting. Bottom right slide is to demonstrate, yeah, I can look at the labs that were done in the hospital. They can be discrete data points. Were they LOINC coded? Are they CPT coded? Are they a proprietary code by the EMR vendor? How do you share that? How do you share the ranges? So, ooh, it's out of range in that system, but guess what? It's in range in my system. So I'm trying to bring up points that will foster discussion as we go on. My last slide is to show if it's done, and this is Kaiser, Colorado data. Again, I don't want to necessarily say, you know, Kaiser, we're doing it all best and right, but this is how I want you to focus on the right side of the slide here. This is our Colorado cardiac risk service. This involves cardiology nurses, PharmDs, primary care, cardiologists, all working together to look at data to understand how they can reduce heart attack risk or prevent a second one. And the slide that I show there is, it may be hard to see on the web, I'm not sure, but the green line are people that participate in the cardiac risk service continually. They got involved early as prevention or right after their first heart attack, and that's the heart attack rate and mortality rate in people that were continually enrolled. And then the yellow line is intermittently enrolled. The red line are patients that never got enrolled in this service. Now, this isn't one e-metric. This isn't just looking at blood pressure. It's not just looking at lipid levels. It's looking at, are they on a beta blocker? Are they on an ACE inhibitor if they're at risk for heart failure? Is their cholesterol controlled? Are they on the statin? Is their blood pressure controlled? If they're diabetic, is their diabetes controlled? You can see this is a multifaceted, multidisciplinary look at how do you manage e-metrics to achieve an improved outcome for the patient themselves. And behind the scenes, there's a lot of data there, but guess what? In our realm, there's still a lot of manual effort here to review that data. How do we produce e-metrics, not just for Kaiser, but across the nation, so that what Farzad was talking about earlier today becomes this? We have quality outcomes based on those e-metrics. So with that, I'm going to stop and turn it over to Chris.
Okay. Technology's looking good here. So, you know, again, I think being very clinically minded, and Donna can jump in on me anytime she wants, because I challenge our team always to develop proactive, preventative ways to help clinicians not make mistakes, because we make mistakes a lot of times because we're not aware of information. So my goal when I started working with informatics was to, how do we take all this data, because most hospitals are fat with data, data here, data there, data everywhere, but how many of us actually take that data and apply it to care? And I think Ted showed that real well here. He's got a lot of data, but it requires a huge amount of manual interaction to get to that point. We started with clinical things such as medication risks. And I'll be honest with you, line up 20 doctors, you're going to get 20 different reasons why we need to use IT, but you're also going to get the same reasons why we need to manage Coumadin appropriately, because our patients don't do a good job of it, and we need to help them. So how do we determine those things? We focused in our institution, once we got our CPOE up and rolling at about 70%, we focused on high-risk drugs, Dilaudid, and national patient safety goals, all the anticoagulants, making sure we were getting education timely, et cetera. Those things were the beginning of our data crunch, where we all of a sudden started saying, hey, you know what, let's look at the individual data, and then let's build some decision support around that data in the IT system that will help the providers make a good decision. And it doesn't take much to stop me from ordering too much Dilaudid, if you tell me sometimes. Yes, I make mistakes. I'm a doctor. We do those things, unfortunately. We're human. But the element of the IT that is so, so powerful, and the ultimate goal of all this is to get to bedside decision support for a nurse, for a doctor, for somebody prescribing, for somebody dispensing and administering medications. And I'll be honest with you, I was so excited to hear what he said, Farzad, earlier about the Coumadin, because honestly, we need to change the claims measures to be clinically relevant measures so we can get the low-hanging fruit. There's a lot out there, believe me. We reduced our Narcan use by 70% in a year with decision support within our IT system. Doctor's company loves us because now our malpractice claims are going to go down because we're not hurting folks with inappropriate doses of Dilaudid. So that's just one of the many things we've done with IT that has an influence. And guess what? Now my doctors say, oh, by the way, I'll use your system because it is better and it does make a difference. Dr. Chodnicki, who's a very good friend and a cardiologist I practice medicine with, challenged me 4 years ago to prove that my CPOE was safer. Now everybody knows it's safer, right? Right. Cardiologists don't believe anything, okay? And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. Because he challenged us, and I challenged Donna and our team to say, let's prove it's safer. So we did with Dilaudid, we did with Coumadin, we did with heparin, Lovenox. We've done it with sepsis, and we're getting ready to do it again. So, and again, and again. And it all is built in on the premise that, guys, we're going to take our data, we're going to ask the clinicians what's important to them, and then we're going to build it. So Peninsula Regional, I went over this stuff. It's just kind of a picture of what I talked about earlier. We've seen our quality awards go up with this kind of embedded tools within our system because it is helping the providers practice good medicine. So getting health grades awards, all that stuff, great. The docs don't really care. The docs want to see the patient go home safely and come back appropriately with the information they need. So we developed this cardiology data analysis team. And by the way, my project doesn't show that it's effectively working. This is actually a current process. And when I got invited, I'm on the high-tech team, and I've been for a couple of years now, talking to guys like David Stumpf and Paul Tang and those guys, or listening to them. I don't know if I can even sit in a room with them, because they're at a level that is just beyond. When they talk, the first two meetings we had, I'm like, what is this? I have no idea. Didn't even understand their terminology. 2 years into this, now I'm starting to get asked, you know, how do we use this at the bedside? And we need more providers who understand the higher-end stuff, but really understand the day-to-day practice of medicine. So cardiology data in our institution is clustered. It's everywhere. The collection process is archaic. It's manual. The abstraction for STS, for ACC, is enormous. The executive summary is 50 pages. I look at it and I about vomit to the fact that there's nothing clinically relevant in there for me to help my doctors practice better medicine. So we wanted to apply some principles that Donna sent me to a lean class, trying to get a doctor smarter. So as I was trying to get lean, and not exercise lean, but I was absolutely trying to drive the fact that we need to take our cardiology data and use it clinically. Imagine that. We haven't done that yet, but we're in the process of doing that, and it's been a really challenging experience. Because Donna's team doesn't own as a PI director, the ACC data or the SCS data, cardiology does. The cardiology director sort of oversees it. Some of the cardiologists look at the executive summary that's 6 months old and try to comment on the basic potential of changing that data prior to it leaving our institution. Right now, I'm going to walk you through what we've done, and it's short and sweet. It's broken. It's absolutely broken. It's nurses without any knowledge of the potential use of this data in the future, putting analytics into a system, never looking at it, never remeasuring it, and this is a community-based hospital. This is what 99% of us out there are doing. Sending this off to a governing body who's applying quality measures to our hospital, saying, you guys either are great or you guys really suck. And I hate to use the terminology because that's the way the docs think about this when they get their slap on the hand for 3-star, 2-star, 1-star, whatever it might be. I'm not doing it is what they say. Well, they really aren't. They don't have a challenge. So our challenge, our goal was to transform poorly managed data via our largest service line and our busiest service line. And we do probably about 500 open hearts a year, including valves. So we have 3 cardiothoracic surgeons. We have a very busy ICU in a rural setting. So we have a big service area to serve, about 120-mile radius. So we're keeping busy trying to transform this. So how do I get my team there? So this is where we started, and this is our current state. We actually went through a lean process, and Donna ran most of it. It's her first one she ran with us, and it was interesting. She did a great job working with one of our engineers. And what was really interesting, the data abstraction was required for 5 areas in cardiology. Same for most everybody. Maryland's a little bit different, maybe with the ACTION trial, but we had Code Blue, Get with the Guidelines. The other 4 go to a product called Cedaron, which is our vendor we send our data out to, which was very interesting, and that's the second box, data transmission. But everybody sees STS, ACC, the ICD data, the ACTION data, and the Code Blue data. ACTION's the EMS data. So it was interesting to see, yeah, we had 5 elements. We have 4 abstractors, folks who are clinical, working part-time, grabbing data. This day is not really that important, though, is it? And I'm being very cynical because it's frustrating to see that we're putting all this effort towards collecting clinical data, and it's not even being looked at by clinicians before sending it out to Cedaron, who dispenses it to whomever needs it for applying regulations to us and quality measures to us. So it's very frustrating to see that. We send this out to Cedaron, to CMS, State of Maryland, Get with the Guidelines, Health Grades. Everybody gets their 5 stars and pops it up on their billboard. Well, what does that mean? I've always been frustrated because I'm a big sports fan, and, you know, I watch ESPN a lot. You know, you know what an ERA is. You know exactly what it is for a pitcher, okay? You know exactly what the statistics are. Professionally, as a doctor, you can't compare me to all the other hospitals in the country and say I'm a good or bad doctor, can you now? Because I'll say, well, my patients are sicker. My patients have more problems than yours. We have no good way to give physicians information. So one of the things that we've tried to look at was how we do scoring of data, and we're still developing this. This is all brand new stuff. We're just digging into it. We've looked at very specific data like our Dilaudid data, saw we had some providers practicing outside of the standards. We educated them using data, showed it to the docs, and they said, oh, my, you're kidding me. 1 milligram of Dilaudid is equivalent to 6 of morphine? This was practitioners practicing medicine in a hospital who didn't understand that. And they were given my mom or grandma, okay, 80-some milligrams of Dilaudid in some cases without understanding the relationship between Dilaudid and morphine for conversion factor. Not doesn't mean they're bad doctors. It's just not necessarily understood. ER physicians use Dilaudid like water in many occasions, and that's okay because they need it in their trauma patients. They need it in their certain types of patients with allergies. But they also need to understand when they give grandma that 2 milligrams of Dilaudid, and she's never had Dilaudid before or morphine or Tylenol, that she's probably going to stop breathing. So there's a wonderful tool here where if you give data to physicians, their behavior will change, and we've proven some of that change. So one of our challenges was getting the quality vendors, the quality initiative programs, the CPI reports, clinical improvement reports, and the payers. Well, imagine that, getting them involved in this. And this is basically how our data went out. Nobody looked at it. Nobody touched it from our hospital. We just abstract it and push it out, happening in every hospital in the country. So our goals were to kind of streamline the abstraction, Let's make it so it's useful information. Embed some validation into the process so we can actually validate these things before it goes to CDRON and CMS. Automate using the informatics platform for concurrent data analysis. And by the way, when CDRON gets it 6 months later before we actually get information back around it. So by now, we've already had damage to 6 months' worth of patients, potentially. And if we had that information concurrently, we could actually do something about it, build decision support, and change behavior of practitioners at the bedside, improving care. Because that's what it's all about. That's where this all goes. So how do we automate it within the system? I don't know the answers to any of these. That's why we're all sitting around this table, because we have to collaborate to figure out. I've worked with McKesson. They've worked with me. They're tired of me calling their support staff. They're tired of me calling their development staff and saying, I need more. I need more. I need more. And at level six, my doctors expect more today, not tomorrow. So we have to have that validation process. We have to have that concurrent review, and we have to have the capability to give the vendors the opportunity to build these things. So we have to develop process and measure the improvements. And one of the things I always am a stickler about is now that I go to meetings, and they actually invite clinicians to meetings in our institution. I was amazed when I first done it, and I were talking about this when I first started at our hospital. Clinicians weren't supposed to be making decisions about things of financial nature, et cetera. That's changing very quickly in many institutions throughout the country, and physicians are becoming, and nurses, leaders in driving a lot of this care. So improvements in scoring are going to be driven by behavior changes, I promise. So now what we're looking at is how do we embed that validation toolkit within there? And this is my vision of where we need to go. Same boxes, we're still sending the same information, but how do we validate it? How do we take the data while it's an e-measure, possibly, and make it something that's useful to me now, so I can review my cardiologist to see how well their INR levels are associated with their Coumadin practice. Get my PharmDs involved with some docs who may need that little extra Dilaudid education. Get my nurses more aware with decision support, so when they go to administer the drug, oh, by the way, they get the same pop-up the doctor does, because we got that old Swiss cheese model, and it works very well, unfortunately, in healthcare, because it does create problems. And we always line up the holes. I have no idea how, but it happens every day in every hospital. We line those holes up. And it's amazing. Some of the things I've gone through to fix Dilaudid, we still found even another problem, because the administration time in the ER is not readily visible to the administration time on the floor. So we may push the drug sooner. And that's a vendor problem partially. That's also a clinical problem, because somebody should have looked before they pushed the drug. So we have both process problems and we have technical problems, and they all hopefully will drive better outcomes if we get a better handle on them. So I just want to display this, because this is really a common problem, is that we're data rich with knowledge poor. And again, you know, I think this definition this was shared, and I think this is a good definition, because it does. It encompasses the capture and use of discrete clinical data to identify and measure quality, patient safety, or service line efficiencies and improvements. So I think the Joint Commission is probably pretty close. And actually, when they come to our hospital, I always tell the reviewer when he walks through, I hope you're ready to learn something, because we're here to teach them better ways to do things, not necessarily learn from them, although we do. But I think we have to share the responsibility to, again, go back to that patient-centered focus. And we have to empower our physicians, our nurses, our pharmacists, and our patients to make better decisions at the point of care. And I think data is absolutely the way we go. So if we get these e-measures right, we can actually prevent Coumadin errors. And I'd love to see a national statistic that would show we have, not zero, because we ain't perfect, that's for sure, but I would love to see the time where we can say we have the fewest errors ever in the history of the United States, not just Peninsula Regional. So that's basically, I think, where we finish off, right? Thanks.
Fantastic. Thanks to you both. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm fascinated with a couple of things. I think we all understand the importance of a culture in an organization, right? And we're seeing the need to... There we go again. From all levels, and I...
Come on over.
Okay. How's that? Oh, much better, Mike. So when we think about, you know, culture changes, we're really expecting a lot in this entire process from every part of the system, aren't we? We're looking at physicians, and I'll just share with you my own personal physician. Great guy. Really loves being a doctor. Recently, just this last year, he had a new computer put into his room. He's part of a health system, big health system. And guess where they put the computer? They didn't put the computer facing me, the patient. They put it facing the wall. So when he does data entry, he has to look away from me, and he has to look at a computer screen. So something as simple as this, I think that we need to consider, and this is a huge area, don't get me wrong. I'm not asking us to look at all of the cultural issues, but it's everything from, you know, data capture starts as simple as ergonomic design, okay? And if we want the culture to change within healthcare, we have to make it ergonomically feasible for the physician to still interact with the patient, right? In a way that they feel still involved and still engaged. And to be honest with you, my physician is so frustrated. He doesn't know how long he's going to stay in practice. He's thinking about doing something else because this is changing what he hoped to be able to do with his patients. And to be honest, as a patient, watching my physician type into a computer, well, that's a whole new thing for me too, right? But when we think about data, okay, I'm going to be the person, the newbie on the block in this group. I'm going to be the person who is going to be kind of sharing with you some of the things I've learned in the last 6 months as far as being on the vendor side, because I think it's very important for all of us to understand we don't really understand what it takes to get this done. And I think that's why it's so important to have all of you here and all of these presenters sharing information. So for instance, big learning for me. Did you, and probably some of you know this, but maybe some of you don't. So a hospital. There's not just one electronic tool capturing data. There might be a hospital-wide system, but guess what? Then there's a ED system. Oh, and then there's another system for the OR. Oh, and if we're in an integrated system, gee, the long-term care side might have a different system. Oh, and the inpatient rehab facility has a different system. Oh, my gosh. Guess what? They're all different vendors. The systems don't speak to each other. So it takes somebody on the technology side to go ahead and bring all this data together. So when we think about measure development and the fact that a measure that's being developed is going to have to take data from all of these different systems, that's a huge consideration because we're going to have manual intervention to ensure that all that data is captured, analyzed, and incorporated into the analytical side to make the reporting correct. Okay? So we're a long way from just pushing a button and making a report happen with everything being automated. So with that, can we talk about some of the challenges at your organization as far as some of these competing systems?
Yeah, I always like to, and you guys aren't just sitting there, so jump in.
Yeah, please.
Because honestly, you know, vendors alike, a lot of the frustrations that we need to collaborate on is, you know, the system she just described has 7 different medication lists. That's bad medicine. We started at our hospital with 7 medication lists literally in 2003. Took me probably about 3 years to get it down to 1, and I still get pushback because the tools are very difficult. It's typically an accurate display of inaccurate information, and it's unfortunate that, you know, we try to depend on the patient to do that when they don't have the knowledge to do that. So that med reconciliation is probably the vein of my existence, and Donna knows I get very frustrated with it because it is something that is so technically dynamic, yet it's such a simple concept, one list. I dare to have an accountant who has more than one book in his office for a customer. So it's a very...
Those exist, but they're breaking the law usually.
Yeah, that's true. And I think there's a law of ethics that we're kind of breaking with not having one list, because it is. It's probably one of the number one areas where we have patient dissatisfaction. So I like to use that example. Problems, allergies, and meds are probably two of the lowest hanging fruit that we have yet to conquer.
Hey, it's John White. Can I barge in?
Please do.
Okay, so I am completely in line with the general principle of making the systems work ergonomically well and making sure the patient's got access to the data. Since we're supposed to be talking about data analytics, I'm not totally sure if the point of what you said is that we need to do our data analysis or capture data in order to be able to do data analysis in such a way that we make sure that the patient has access to that information or is getting outcomes from that information that is relevant to them. What was the point of that?
Well, I'll be honest with you. We don't know if they're getting the correct information. So I'm not sure if there's benchmarks available for accuracy of completion. And I don't know, in the clinical analytics world, it's basically hard enough to see, do they have a list or don't they have a list, first of all. And starting very simple with that, I think, is relatively very, very important.
Oh, and Chris, my apologies. I wasn't talking to you. I was talking actually to the previous speaker.
Oh, okay.
I just turned my microphone off. Hi. Yeah, this is Karen. Actually, it was more in context to changing how we do medicine.
Okay.
And, yeah. But you're bringing up some important things, because when we start looking at patient engagement, which is really critical in all of this, and the dynamics of some of the proposals in Meaningful Use Stage 2 in the NPRM, we're asking for data to be made available to patients through a portal, and encouraging patients to actually go out and get their data. And this is the beginning of some really exciting opportunities for the future. Because right now, obviously, the goal is to get these portals up and running and to start feeding data to them. Moving forward, though, how wonderful will it be to be able to have patient-reported outcomes through these patient portals, right?
Yep.
We got a long way to go to get there, but I think we can all see the future on the horizon and look forward to actually getting to that point.
Well, I think one of the reason, and I asked Donna to come here. She didn't come on her own. I told her I need her to come because we've been going through this meaningful use process of collecting information, especially the quality measures. We'd sit in a meeting, and Donna was put in charge of quality measures, and she said, "Well, what am I supposed to do with those?" And I started saying, "Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess we're just looking at them. We're testing that we can do this." And I said, maybe we need to compare them to what we're currently collecting via abstraction. So some of the abstractors, especially our stroke abstractor, she started looking at it, and she, I'm just not seeing it. It's apples and oranges. So the quality measures we've been handed for meaningful use compared to what my abstractors are intuitively looking at and grabbing, I think that's a big piece of this. Is what are they supposed to do with these measures? Once we have the measures, I've challenged our vendor to give me a tool that says, okay, here's your data, okay, here's your variances, you're 100% here, you're 100% there, you're 70% here. So what does that 70% mean? What's my numerator and denominator, and how do you get into the math of that? Our clinical abstractors, they do diligence on that, and they actually validate it while they're doing the abstraction 6 months later. How do we build that functionality into e-measures? Because that's where it needs to go. And again, it's not there now, but that's the vision we have to get to, so that the abstractors then can be used for knowledge base and not, or for validation, I guess, at that point of the data, not necessarily collection and validation. If we take the collection away from them, does that hurt the process? They're telling me it does.
Listening to all this today, I've written down some notes. Oh, I've written down some notes here. The
process that the process mapping that we did for our cardiac data and the five databases that feed the heart service line, the huge gap and no analytics. We have no analytics around all this data that is put in, and that was very evident to us as we went through this process. So I don't know about all of you if you're from hospitals, but I think that's a huge gap in hospitals, a lack of resources and the knowledge with the clinical analytics. That's where it's at, because we have papers, reports this high with tables of data, and we question the validity and the correctness of it, but there's no analytics, nobody to take that and then look at the outliers or look at the things that need to be addressed as far as performance improvement. So that was the reason why we went through this exercise, because my global question is, why do we have all these different vendors pulling at hospitals and then making it even more difficult as the months go by, because they're integrating their, like the STS or the ACC database, they're viewed by the specialists, the cardiologists and thoracic surgeons, as their premier database, that they want the hospital to use these databases. And now we've got the payers saying, if you use the STS database, then you qualify more for centers of excellence. So I think it's becoming more and more difficult for hospitals to establish, like the speaker this morning, the doctor.
Dr. Musher's
husband. Yes, honoring parsimony. I think that is absolutely essential. If hospitals are going to get a handle on improving care for patients, then we've got to establish some standard measures, e-measures, make them more outcome-oriented, because I don't foresee any solution to process measures and the way they put inclusion and exclusion criteria in all these definition manuals that are this thick and change every 6 months. It's nearly impossible, I think, for hospitals to, and especially with resources, limited resources. Put your money in the analytics and make the measures outcome oriented. And that's my wish list. And I think that's what it all comes down to. But I think we shoot ourselves in the. I would like to see the NQF come up with, or make recommendations to establish standard measures nationally, get Joint Commission on their side and all these different payers and the registries, and saying, look, this is what's going to benefit our patients the most. We need to focus on this. And anyway.
So this is Ted Pauline again. And you know, the EHR-HIE interoperability work group has come up with some transmission standards. That was published, I think, last fall in November last year, about transmission standards for interoperability and in LOINC coding for labs. And I forget them all off the top of my head of which ones they've agreed on as far as using interoperability transmission standards. But okay, so if that's the agreed-upon list for lab and problem list diagnosis and for whatever standard it is for pharmaceuticals and vaccines is what I'm trying to say, then there's the next step, which was you're alluding to. So if we have transmission standards, but we still have the issue of, is the data that's being transmitted accurate? And that's where this kind of next step of understanding where eMetrics is. So I'll give you an example. Blood pressure. Let's start with it. That should be an easy one, right? I mean, blood pressure, are they hypertensive or are they not hypertensive? We have two discrete data points. We have a systolic and we have a diastolic. I mean, okay, we transmit numeric values. It should be discrete. Do they have a diagnosis of high blood pressure in their problem list? Is it an accurate one? Was the high blood pressure diagnosis made when they are in acute trauma, emotional distress? Well, yeah, they're hypertensive then. Are they a hypertensive patient that needs treatment? No, the next time you do it, they're not under emotionally trauma. They've recovered from the death of their child. They've had their laceration stitched up. You know, they've recovered. They're no longer hypertensive, but they have this carrying diagnosis of hypertensive. How do we scrub the data using e-metrics? Basically, we're talking about using e-metrics to do artificial intelligence in chart review and delivering a scrubbed panel of true hypertensive. So example in real life in Colorado is we have 80,000 people listed as uncontrolled hypertensive. When you scrub the data, that's manually scrubbing the data, it's 20,000. You had it right on.
25%.
Yeah. He knew the data before. So how can Chris know that data, but the system doesn't know that data? How do you take Chris's knowledge, make an e-metric to scrub the data automatically, so now I'm not spending manual effort to find the 20,000 true hypertensives?
Just
that's what we're here to solve. Oh, my goodness. That's an easy.
Just don't put Chris out of work because Chris does good work.
Yes, this is Sarah Tun, and I'm from the American Academy of Neurology, and we are a national measure developer. So we follow the process that AMA PCPI developed. They're the biggest lead measure developer on the physician side. So by choosing to do that, first of all, we're standardizing physician measurement. We currently have several measures out there for claims, and we're struggling because we need to move to e-specifications. So we understand now the quality data model going into the measure authoring tool. So what we found out when we started to look at that, it was amazing because we learned that we needed a higher nomenclature, an understanding of nomenclature and vocabulary. And so I was really glad that you were going to be here to speak to Kaiser, because Kaiser is international, and you've adopted SNOMED, LOINC, RxNorm, all these standard vocabularies. And so that is the standard going forward. So ICD-9 and 10 are 77,000 codes, 120,000 codes. SNOMED is 335,000 codes with 950,000 relationships. Now, I just learned this in the last couple months. And as a measure developer going to NQF to have to create e-measures, I have to have those in specifications. But I find out that quality data model is a middle step to measure authoring. So now I have to go back and find training for this very technical mapping. So then I come here and I hear the Kaiser story, and I'm like, oh, no, they don't have it figured out. Right. So I can even go to slide 18 and 19, and I was disappointed. Because what you showed here is that, you know, you are able to get, let's see if I can get to slide 18 and 19. So here you are, 18. So then I'm like, oh, good. I think I understand now that my medical group that does all these measures, I mean, it's a very formal process how we come up with measures. So when you say we hope to standardize, you know, it's experts and it's multidisciplinary. We bring a panel together. They look at all the guidelines and the evidence. So the physicians want these measures to be evidence-based, because if they're going into accountability and payment, and you want that for them too. I mean, you don't want five physicians here and 10 there, and then you have these different, and going into accountability programs. So you have to see it from that standpoint. But so then I saw this slide 18, and I thought, oh, that's how they got to the use of SNOMED and LOINC. But now I also learned that we need to have HL7 templates to go into care, chronic care. You know, the data architecture. So what I think that means is if I zoom in on this, I'm sorry, I'm just going to take a minute here. So over here where it's CT abdomen. Okay, so for example, Dr. Palin. Did I? Pauline, yes. Pauline. So over here, he says, oh, my gosh, you know, this is all text, and I have to read it, and then I have to read all the labs. So where the SNOMED and the low ink can help us is that if the medical specialty societies would take a step back, understand all this high level, and create templates for the care documents. So we would do stroke. We would have a neuro exam template in there. And for our members, it would benefit because, you know, it fits their model, not the internal med, not the family practice. But so the problem is I don't think you're reaching the right think tanks, or they don't want to do it, or like the Academy is ahead with measure developers. So, and you have to support them to understand this higher level. One other comment I want to make is I heard Dr. Tang speak, and then I'm very heavy on the clinical side and the CMS side, what the CQMs are, et cetera. But the technology, ONC, it's like, wow, but you don't talk to each other. And on top of that, ONC, AHRQ, so even the two partners of ONC and CMS or HHS, maybe those two report to HHS. But anyway, then AHRQ is your research arm, and they're quite different than clinical trial because AHRQ is, in practice. Dissemination, get it to the practicing physicians. So I'm really, really encouraged by this, but I think you have to take a step back if you want high-level standards that come from medical specialty societies that work with a bunch of other, you know, panel, is where this should go rather than each your group saying this is what we're going to create an e-measure and validate it, and you can locally adapt it once it's there. But if this area has to move, you need to kind of redirect it to the measure developers or national groups that come up with the standards. Thank you.
And it's, to jump onto that, it's also working with the vendors also, because do you develop that neurological tool by all checkboxes? Do you incorporate Dragon Speak and have it automatically coded as a physician is dictating it, because right now that's free text. But what if you could develop methodologies to take that free text and standardize it as it goes from speech to text? And then it's not just speech to text, because that's what Dragon is doing right now. There's an intermediate step to say, yes, speech to text, but it becomes discrete data elements that are codified and standardized as it goes, and you know that takes some brain power to bring the coalesce groups of the vendors, the medical societies, the standards generating bodies together. You're right. Right now we're really siloed in a lot of these areas.
And it's John White from ARC. I just want to resonate with my neurologist friend's comments and say that even though I am a bureaucrat, I am also a family physician. And at ARC, we've got a real strong philosophy of nothing about us without us when it comes to measuring the quality of care delivered by clinicians.
I just want to make one statement about the vendor issue, is that basically you don't talk the same language, and the vendors are way ahead. I mean, it's like, here's your tool, and I have your answer. And they're now with ONC Meaningful Use 2, thank goodness, they're making EHRs more responsible and say, no, you can't just make this up. You have to talk to each other. You have to have, a reporting platform on top. And so those things are really good. But so these kind of meetings are wonderful when you have a real mix of people. And so thank you for that.
So if I can add one more thing, it's Chris Snyder again. The payers, the almighty payer. So they want intercall. They don't care about your guidelines. They're going to deny my payment. How do we align payment structure with this? Because now you have a severity-adjusted APRDRG in the state of Maryland that says, didn't meet intercall criteria, make them an observation. Oh, by the way, we're not going to pay for that either because you didn't document well. So the documentation in the record, and I think there has to be a payer alignment in this also, because we have a we have dysfunction in our system. You might see it written one way. Well, that doesn't meet intercall criteria, and it was 6 months ago, so I don't remember what I was doing. So one of the challenges I have in my utilization life is getting physicians to document medical necessity. And one of the challenges you're describing, which I would love, and I am totally on board with what you're describing, because I am all about the clinical governing bodies driving these guidelines, period. We need standard guidelines. We do not have good guidelines, and medicine has done a poor job of housekeeping, I believe, with maintaining our own guidelines based on our society's recommendations on the evidence. That's where it needs to begin. But then the payers need to adopt to that somehow, and I don't know how to do that.
Yeah. So we are also a measure, a guideline developer, and our measures come from the guidelines. So you synthesize the guidelines from the rich research, and then from that you pick 8 to 10 measures to put into practice rather than 150 recommendations. So it's measures are implementation of guidelines. So the IOM put out a report on guidelines, and we happen to be a very good systematic review, do that first, and then go from conclusions to recommendations. And we're putting more of a consensus process in there, and we're addressing cost. And but this is new. I mean, we have 70 projects in the pipeline. We used to publish 8. And now that we changed this and are putting patients on our panels, we may do 4 a year. So it reduces the and it, but it, they're more careful, and we think they'll be broader rather than just these component pieces. But it's going back to the source. So going back to the source is the guidelines. And since we're within an organization, our measure people talk to guidelines and say, we need this. You need standards. Put cost in there. Highlight patient preference sensitive issues while you're doing this rich review. Tell us the quality, the outcome assessment tools we should use, because you're looking at the outcomes. So, yeah, it really you need to push back on your society on their guideline process.
Yeah, and if I could throw one example at you, clinically very sound medicine, VTE prophylaxis, okay? I have probably 50 guidelines on my desk that don't necessarily have good evidence behind them, but are still used in practice, aspirin, for example, post-hip versus Coumadin or Lovenox or whatever, best practice. Those things are all, again, need to be vetted, but they also need to have some appearance to the provider as being standards of care. And I love when we do something called an I-form and we build things that actually give physicians, this is first-line evidence. We have 1A guidelines for evidence. I mean, why aren't we using those in these tools? And I suggest that when we, as we build e-measures, we attach the evidence to them and make sure that it's kept. And the maintenance of that is what I spend my week doing, is maintaining those measures in our institution at least.
So you actually bring up another thing we have to do is actually do e-recommendations. So back at our institution, I'm bringing a trainer in to train us in all this high-level language. And then our guideline people, will, and then those e-recommendations can go into clinical workflow versus
so,
the measures.
So it's so, John. I just want to briefly, we used exactly that term in a demonstration that we did not too long ago. I'll let you guys keep talking, but at some point I just want to flag following up on e-recommendations. If anybody, I'm sorry if I cut the conversation. If anybody's talking, I can't hear you.
Is this the way you keep people on track and on target? Yeah. So building on the previous comments, I'm from the American College of Rheumatology, also a measure developer, a guideline developer, and we have a clinical registry, so kind of represents that spectrum of e-measures in health IT. We're going through the process now of really focusing on and building in e-measure specification into our development process and really linking guidelines to measures to clinical decision support moving forward. We're really struggling with building out these e-specifications considering what's going on in clinical practice in the data analytics and what's really going to help and improve practice, working on the reality of data collection, data storage management right now, but thinking through this timeline of when these measures are going to hit systems and where, when they're going to be implemented, what's the reality of data going to look like at that point? What is health information exchange going to look like? Struggling with simple things like where is a PPD stored right now? Where is that going to be 2 years down the road? Are these meaningful use regulations really going to change anything? So I think I would be thrilled to take back any guidance or recommendations on what we can do to think through data analytics and what's helpful and how we can develop our measures for today and tomorrow.
Well, it's Chris again, and I think one of the things that I challenge our vendors for is don't give me a measure without giving me a way to measure it. Okay, and that's one of the most frustrating things I get. And I always tell them, I said, don't give me a measure without a baseline measure. So give me a benchmark based on the college recommendations or whatever. But don't give me a measure without giving me a measurement, because I have to be able to remeasure it in order to show effectiveness. That's our outcomes proof. That's our quality proof. That's our process proof that we have to take back to the clinicians to say, we're doing a better job because of this. Because they don't believe just because Chris said so. I guarantee that. They'll believe Donna, but they won't believe me.
So, Chris, your comment on benchmarking is important because unless there's e-metrics in benchmarking. What's the e-measurement for benchmarking? Because if you're comparing apples to tangerines, or worse than that, you're comparing a organic to a non-organic, you're not going to have very good idea of how you're doing on a benchmark. And I'll give you an example. Just last week, I was looking at referral rates. How do you report referral rates? 24 different numerator denominator adjustments I found in the literature. Well, which benchmark do I use to compare how my docs are doing on referral rates to the community, to the nation, to other Kaiser regions, when there's 24 reported quote-unquote benchmarks? So there's another area of how do your rheumatologists compare to another rheumatologist compared on evaluation of joint involvement? How about letting the patients do their own reporting of which joints are involved? Oh, now we got patient-reported outcomes. Ooh, another metric. How do we do that? You know, so this is not an easy thing to slice and dice, but we have to do this kind of hard work.
Yeah, and at what point are you comparing data collection versus actual clinical quality, and how do you standardize that and really educate physicians and promote that? I guess it's not just physicians. It's the clinical team documenting this data across the nation when you've got, you know, rural middle America versus the Kaisers of the group that's not equivalent. So how do we fill in those gaps, not just develop some e-specification that's going to go out and be implemented, you know, thousands of different ways in each practice?
Oh, I hate to do this, but I have been clearly told that I have to stop this conversation that has taken off and has great energy, and we have to feed ourselves. So some of you may have received your little card, and okay, that you have to go back with that card and collect your lunch. If you haven't got a card, that means you probably didn't buy one. So you're
Anisha.
There's Anisha. Anisha's got the information as far
Thank
as
you.
Where you can go. We're going to take 15 minutes, and then we're going to come back, and then we're going to go right back into this great discussion. Okay, thanks, everyone.
For the folks that are on the phone, if you would keep your session open on your computer, if you need to step away, just keep your phone line open as well, if you don't mind.
Okay.
We will keep you updated on when we resume.
And then set to go out.
Sure. And for those of you inside the room that did not purchase lunch, I have a list of places here. I can also tell you what's close by and quick, like Subway. So if you want to come to me, I have a map and I have a list. But in terms of a 15-minute turnaround, there are a couple places around I'll tell you about. Thanks.
We're going to go ahead and reconvene. So I hate to interrupt people's discussions, but if we could reorganize around the table, that would be great. Thanks. Okay, everybody, how are we doing? Everybody fortified? All right. And don't worry, you can make all the noise you want. Got to keep everybody's blood sugar up here. Okay, so as you'll see, we have a slide up. And what we're going to do is we're going to start going through the three main questions that we really need to address to help NQF in capturing data that HHS is interested in, right? That's why we're here today, is to help the process. So what's going to happen is, as we start to identify best practices, Beth's going to go ahead and type those onto the screen. And then at the end of this, we're going to have another break, and then we're going to have a reconvening of everybody, and all of the different groups are going to report out, okay? So we can see where everybody netted out at the end of the day. So with that, if we could go ahead. Oh, yes, go ahead. Oh, can you use the mic?
Can you use the mic? What are the standards or the criteria for best practices that we'll be using?
Now, that's a good question.
Ted Nars is the best practice. Always will be.
Uh-oh. Yeah, well, first of all, there are so many different areas we can obviously get into, but we really should focus on data analytics. So when we look at what are some of the best practices that have been used around data analytics to account for, you know, e-measures. Now, most of the e-measures that are going to come to mind are stage one, meaningful use e-measures, right? So perhaps what are some of the best practices, key learnings, really, from trying to make that initial migration over from abstraction to electronic measures? Go ahead.
And I think it's a great question that you just asked, and I think if I think about it in terms of this, you know, what are the best practice examples for the development and implementation of e-measures, I think as an industry we're struggling in some ways, and we're definitely learning, and that while there are some practices out there that seem to be working, that it is about incremental progress forward, and how some of these practices look today probably will look very different in the future as we continue to learn about development and then implementation of e-measures. I mean, I'd be interested in others if you agree with that or not.
Okay, let's start talking to our two key experts here.
And folks on the phone, please feel free to chime in at any point.
Absolutely. Thank you. Ted, Chris, what do you think should be captured from today from your key learnings?
Where do you start? I really, the e-measures that we've, with stage one at a station, have really been, we haven't been able to validate them, honestly. The measuring capability is not there yet. It doesn't give us that concurrent capability. And you know, again, I don't want to pick on vendors, but it is what it is. And currently, we're not even able to see what we're attesting to without going into the raw data and doing manual abstraction. So it's a challenge, and it's a frustration that I think that, again, if you give me something to measure, then give me the tool to measure it with. Don't just say, make it up. And I honestly, I think, I don't know, is that a...
That's a gap, but that's okay.
Okay.
But that's a good gap, because
I don't
you
know
have,
if I have a best practice.
Yeah. How did you, is there any way that you've tried to rectify this issue?
No.
Okay.
There's been negotiation. So that's about all I can tell you. We're just waiting for code to make it right.
Okay.
So I think, you know, again, there's a dependency in a relationship, and it's not that they're not trying. It's just, it is what it is. It's bigger than a bread box. I think that the vendors, please speak up in here. I'm not going to speak for you guys, but I think that you guys are really just starting to realize that it's important to give us these measuring tools. Again, if I look back at our e-measures within our institution, for example, the lauded, Coumadin, heparin, those e-measures, we've had a lot of success stories. But I tell you what, starting simple is the key. So being very individualized and specific, and I'm afraid that as I see the measures for stage two, that we're going way too far, and we're trying to remeasure the claims data in a non-claims environment. It doesn't match. And you know, as I look at the information with the vendors that are giving us our reports back, it's not going to work. There's no way. The beginning and the end points don't match. And I don't see a solution within the tools that are going to let us do that. So I think there's misalignment right now in what they're proposing for stage two. And again, maybe that's another gap. I have a lot of gaps, but no solutions, I guess.
So I have a combo answer to number one and two. It's a gap and it's a best practice all at the same time. The best practice is that, and maybe this is coining of a term, algorithmize.
Oh, wow. That is
awesome. And that is algorithmize the how you define a patient as we put them into a registry. So we at Kaiser had to develop the logic that would help the manual process. So there's both. There is programmatic logic, and there's still the manual process. If we could standardize, algorithmize that process to say this hypertension patient really is a hypertension patient, this diabetic really is a diabetic, this COPDer is really a COPDer. Now, that standardization process isn't something, you know, unique to Kaiser. Everybody in this room, their organizations that they represent, probably have some algorithms they use in order to define, make from a superset of patients a subset of really the true patient that has that disease entity. In rheumatology, it happens, right? It happens as, well, who is the Dilaudid patient that you're trying to monitor, or the Coumadin patient? So coming together on standardizing those algorithms could be a best practice, because everybody does it, but they're doing it in different ways. Well, if we're going to have a national idea of, well, who is the diabetic, we better have some standard algorithms of how we do that. So each of us have best practices. Let's come together and define that best practice as a unified. Now, that presents a gap, too. And the gap is in our break in the break to get our lunch. We were talking, and it's going to become maybe worse rather than better as we go from CPT ICD to 9 to 10 or to SNOMED. It's a good news, bad news story. We're going to have more granularity. Great. We're going to have more discrete, codifiable disease states. Great. We're going to have more granularity. We're going to have more discrete disease states. Ooh, that's terrible. Because right now, I log in, I want to choose a code, I have 25 depression codes to choose from. That's going to go to 150 depression codes. Is there a way to help me at the front line of dealing with this patient what the right depression code is to choose from? So it's a good news, bad news story as we progress to more granularity in the coding system. So this is where the best practice and the gap can be joined. Can we take those best practice algorithms to define what this person really is and help the person at the point of care, the nurse, the pharmacist, the doctor, everybody on that care team, help them make that right choice of that discrete data?
Hi, if I could jump in here. Brandon Crosser, I'm with the National Database of Nursing Quality Indicators, and we're just beginning our path down e-measures, but I was hoping to be able to toss in a couple things, and maybe the rest of the group could help apply some of these things to e-measures. Earlier we were talking about outliers and illogical data. We said, you know, out of the 80,000, you expect 20,000 patients to actually have the hypertension, right? Well, that's information that we know, and if we can base some kind of outlier detection on that information to start triggering us to look at either those outlying data points and classifying them as either one of the 20,000 or one of the other 60,000, and it may take several different ways to look at it. And as far as illogical data, we know just to avoid getting junk data, there's upper and lower bounds on many data elements. If we can just stop that from the beginning on a validation process, I think that could help. And earlier we were talking about benchmarking. The way we currently do this is we present our data as here's your we measure at the unit level, the nursing unit level, rather than the hospital level. And we say, here's your, say, HAPU, your hospital-acquired pressure ulcer rate. Well, that's pretty meaningless unless you have some type of context. So you need to be able to identify and even compare two different peer groups. Am I going to compare against other hospitals that are in the same bed size category as me or other academic medical centers? Maybe you want to go on a geographical comparison, but to me, just an outcome measure without any context is really tough to put into kind of place. So I was wondering if anyone could maybe try to think about how we could extend that to the e-measures.
Well, it goes back to how do you define that numerator and denominator. So the numerator part here is what I was just talking about. Standardized ways to define that pressure ulcer patient. Once we have numerator definition standardized, and that has to be hand in hand with e-metrics, obviously. Then you have to start. Similar to what I talked to a few minutes before the break was that I had 24 methods of understanding how to measure the denominator for referral rates. Well, then you have to apply that same kind of algorithm logic to define that denominator. So, so which one of these 24 methods do I choose versus in this situation you choose this method because it aligns, I can compare the pressure ulcer rate in like facilities or like communities or in like healthcare plans or whatever. So you start having to define the e-metrics for both the numerator and the denominator. That's how I look at it.
So what's the definition of the outcome you want to get to also? Because I think the questions you're asking, and if I – forgive me, I work with the nurses who collect our data. They send it to you guys, and it's randomized, and it's – I don't know. I'm not real fan of some of the data that's going out because it doesn't paint a cumulative picture of the care at the bedside, which is why we're all sitting here. And I'm very frustrated when they bring the data back or the reports that you guys send out. I'm not picking on you, but it's when I look at it, I just kind of cringe and say, really? Is that really what's happening when I'm out there practicing? So when practitioners are recognizing data analytics coming back that is ineffective, same thing with STS, ACC, I see things that are – there's no way this is happening because I know concurrently we're managing this and monitoring this in our CABG patients. They are getting their antibiotics stopped at 24 hours, period. Well, the STS come back says, well, it's only 50%. Uh-uh, something wrong. The data is not there, and I think we have to define our endpoints here a little better. You know, I think we're jumping in with both feet with, like, stroke. When I saw the stroke thing that McKesson gave us for core measures to measure that with the e-measures, I was just like, you got to be kidding me. There is no way that there will be enough granularity in that information for it to purpose what she needs to report out to CMS. There's no way. Absolutely no way, because there's so much interpretation, it's not built in the system yet. So we're being handed content that's not necessarily, abstract enough to give you the clinical picture that's reality. And I don't know what the answer to this is, but again, it's just one, two, and three altogether. Maybe it's development recommendations. We need to define what he's talking about. We need a definitive start and a definitive end point, a very specific indicators that are measurable and are going to get our clinicians to say, okay, this means it's something to me now. I'm going to use it. So what's next? And I think we have to be real careful, Pan, saying we can throw all the core measures and just put them in the order entry system and make the nurses document tobacco follow-up and educate all these things. And your decubitus ulcers, well, is it stage 1, 2, 3, or 4? Well, you know, it's tough. A lot of this stuff is subjective clinical practice. We have to get endpoints that are realistic. I love the idea of Coumadin. Let's take Coumadin and INRs. It's simple. It's a no-brainer. Let's make everybody in the country excel and be the best they can be at Coumadin management. Let's fix one at a time. And I know that's going to be a difficult challenge, but I challenge this group at NQF to say, let's keep it simple. Let's start. Let's get the low-hanging fruit. And let's get away from trying to fix the world with IT. But because there's so much process and analytics are tied to it, there's no way you can do that. Again, this is my opinion, but as I build these tools, the simpler the tool is, the simpler the output, the more the clinicians are going to say, aha. And if you get your clinicians to buy into this, all of a sudden a lot of other things are going to change.
So, Chris, I think in the last 60 seconds of what you just said captured everything of what Farzad Matashari was saying to us this morning in his 5 to 6 principles. You know, the simplicity, to be inclusive, to really define what is it that, you know, that we need to measure, what are we trying to do, and then start to develop some steps around how we need to get there.
And having both feet on the ground, but not both on the ground at the same time, because I think that's a really good point. You know, we have jumped in with both feet. And we've been really focused on the care delivery at the moment. Since data is all about collection of the data at the very beginning and also the measure developers, I'm just wondering what kind of gaps are there that we've already started to talk about some as far as what the needs are for the measure developers, because I think one of the things we're trying to do is we're running out of the gate really fast, right? And I can tell you that, in fact, two of us at lunch were just talking about the fact that the growth curve to understand, to go from chart abstraction into understanding MOIC code, SNOMED, RX norm, and how all of this interplays together, and just understanding technology, right? EHRs, data integration, HIEs, interoperability, right? There are a lot of terms that are important, right? But I'm just wondering, do you think we're going too fast for the measure development world to get caught up with the technology understanding that's required to do this transformation?
I think from our viewpoint, one of the big gaps is that we can develop measures. I can specify codes. I can put it all in a pretty Excel spreadsheet. But then what happens? I think there's a huge gap between us defining measures and educating our members and then getting that implemented in the vendor world. We're willing and ready to work with any and all the vendors that want to implement measures, but we need to know what we need to give the vendors in order to make this implementation consistent across all of our providers. So we're kind of lacking in knowing what you need from us.
So I have a question to that. As you said, you know, sounds like not a problem to develop the measures to e-specifications. Is that what you're talking about?
I wouldn't say not a problem. But
it can be done.
Yeah. Part of the problem is knowing what you expect and what would help and what we can give to you so that we have a complete package when we finish and have everything wrapped up for review.
Yeah. So it isn't really so much what the vendors expect, I would say, in terms of speaking from a vendor perspective, we see it that if the measures are being developed towards according to the e-measure specification and the quality data model and the measuring authoring tool, then in theory, then it should be set up that a vendor then can start to consume that and within their solution. their EHR. But my question to you is that in terms of developers, do you think that there is a need, though, to kind of test the theory or the concept, the measure concept, really in an EHR environment before it's actually published out there for both vendors and the providers?
I would say no, the publishing or the measure concept, or we've published measures to get them out there in use. And so what's happening is that some groups that are savvy will pick them up and put them in, but McKesson, for example, might not do it quite right. So the real route for this should be a high-level training, intense training, you know, high-level, so the physicians understand these concepts of SNOMED, ARCS, LOINC, and then specified, because this is in the National Library of Medicine. I mean, this, and if you pull down tools, that will teach you how to map your measure to this hierarchy. And so we are having problems specifying, understanding the higher level, not just getting into measure authoring tool. We can guess, but that's like, you know, a middle part. So if you have the higher understanding, you're going to go farther and we'll be able to get to clinical workflow and protocol on certain things much quicker. So I think if measure developers could get the training on, you know, SNOMED, RxLink Norm, how the transition from ICD-9 and 10, that they get mapped to SNOMED. So then you get past that point, and then there's a training point of QDM, how QDM is your shrunken SNOMED, and then QDM gets you into the measure authoring tool. And there are EHR specs. Great, that's easy. And then everybody can access those HQMF formats, and that's the standard. But in order for measure developers to really get in this game, I mean, there are very few that do independent stuff like we do because it takes staff, and you have to pay $50,000 per measure set. And even our guidelines, just the review of a guideline is $80,000 for just the literature review. So there's a lot being pushed on medical societies, and so we need that higher-level training on those international vocabularies, and then the QDM to measure authoring tool, that there might be some things we'd need there. And then the EHR vendors can pick it up, so we don't have to go to each EHR vendor. You would tell the EHR vendors to get it off this HQMF format. Another thing that's needed is, so then when I was talking to a representative from CINA, she said, well, but the technical standards aren't there. So then what happens on the EHR side is, or you go to your HR and they say, well, I don't have to do that because it's not in certification. So you've got some people that take the high road because it's the right way to go. You know, we're going to do that. It's just like us. We're looking at the high-level language. We don't really need to, but I'm going to try to convince my board to pay our training to understand this high-level stuff. And it's expensive. So maybe some of you will hold the training and you give us some money and we'll invite everybody.
So I got kind of a million-dollar question. Which measures get the biggest bang for the buck?
So this is another problem, is that nationally, you know, there's four, you know, the preventive stuff and the million hearts. But here we are, a National Medical Specialty Society, and we have three on the WHO list. WHO, the World Health Organization, has just put on non-communicable diseases, and three of them are stroke, Alzheimer's, and epilepsy. So that's what our priorities should be globally, but they're not. We're working on ALS, Parkinson's, neuropathy. We have stroke, dementia. We have headache is next. So we want to get these in the pipeline. And there's a very, and I even think we should keep doing this. But, you know, from a priority standpoint, plus we have 700 diseases. So it's not like we can say stroke and Alzheimer's and the next 10 years we're dedicated to that. So there's a real...
So we're eating the ice cream from the bottom up. What's the, my question is here is, you know, I'll be honest with you. You know, I hear there's 700 measures, but from the clinical standpoint, what's going to get me the most improved quality, which is going to improve cost for the patient? Because honestly, what you're asking is, she's got all these great measures, but which one's important to me? The rheumatologist, the hospitalist, the, you know, and the nurse. Which one's the most important one to us that's going to change behavior? Because you heard this morning Dr. Mashari say, Coumadin. Why are we ignoring the fact we already have evidence showing medication safety is our number one cause of cost? So we're trying to develop this huge, huge database, the National Library of Medicine, okay? We're trying to develop that. Well, we can't do that, okay? We have this low-hanging fruit that at my hospital, what we did is focused on those errors and those potential problems. And what we did was we took those errors and we asked the docs, which one is important to you? Do you understand this? And the doctor said, hell yeah, I understand that. But then 10% said no. So for that 10%, they get decision supported because of the variances within their data. Their clinical analytics showed that that 10% needed education. We fixed that, and guess what? All of a sudden, our dollars went down. Same thing with sepsis. We were missing the lactate on admission. We got the lactate drawn. All of a sudden, we're saving for 30 lives a quarter, and which worked out to be about $1.5 million in our hospital per that group of patients for severe sepsis. Very focused, very defined area. Doctors know Institute of Medicine has a great guideline by Manny Rivers years ago. He implemented it. Nobody was using it because they didn't know about it, or they didn't think about it, or they didn't order the lactate, or they didn't look at the SIRS criteria. So the physicians know where the problems are, but nobody's asking.
Well, no, as a matter of fact, the guidelines are the evidence, and only 18% uptake. 18% uptake, because all it is read the guideline and do the best you can. So measures are hoping to increase uptake, and by getting measures into EHR, you know, but we don't have those measures. So exactly what you're doing, you should keep doing. You do local, you know, you're the medical information officer. You do the data, get your little group together, say, look at this high volume, look at the problems here, get the right people together, and, you know, the intervention. So even as measure developers, we're going to have to create intervention tools to help move, you know, where the baseline is. But you're right, the measure, they're not quite there yet. And if we could get everybody on board to understand how to get, it's kind of like mesh in PubMed. I mean, the SNOMED, and it's not a new coding system. It's international.
It's more like spaghetti.
Yeah.
And it's bleeding. So, and
but the reason why you can Google and get to those terms,
yeah,
I mean, that there's a Google is wonderful. Google is doing some standard, you know, and here it is. So that's what we need to do with medicine, but get groups together to say that, this, and this should pop up and be number one,
sure,
versus the one that paid the most to get theirs on the
list. So, and one proof of concept, you want to add this on number one. Our sepsis initiative to date, again, 130 lives in 2 years. And how do we measure that? Using benchmarks from Premier in a collaborative. Okay, so we took our data and we measured it, and we saved lives with it. There are three other surrounding small hospitals that our ER group manages also. So we started at our hospital. Guess what? We proved to the docs that it was effective. So guess what? All the other hospitals adopted the exact same program. It was contagious. But it was a very focused model on a specific population that was driven by clinical staff, not by IT. So, and I think that's where the message is. We got to find some things that are wins here. And I'm telling you, this could be something that could extrapolate throughout the entire country. This isn't rocket science. It's evidence-based. It's just we need support. And now we had to do a lot of that build, but the vendor supported us, and they did a great job supporting us, and that partnership made it happen.
So that actually is a great representation of recommendations that we need to start capturing as well as a result of this meeting. Because if we can go ahead and take something local, you know, you've already done a pilot, right, proof of concept, and how do we go ahead and bubble this up and get this noticed and perhaps replicate it, right?
Something other McKesson did that was really kind of cool is they actually opened it up to other providers, so they invite us to meetings and we present our successes. This wasn't a IT success. This was a clinical success supported by IT. It was hardwired by IT. And I think that's an element that, you know, you need to see. And I'm sure other vendors are doing this. I don't think we're unique. But it's interesting. It's crossed over borders. Even at HIMSS, I was talking to guys from Epic, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How did you do it? It wasn't the IT that did it. It was the awareness of from the IT that right. gave the clinicians the ability to make the difference. So, you know, this could cross. And I think there's other people out there doing this. In fact, I know there are because I've talked to them in networking. But I think it was very powerful. And that kind of – that's contagious when you start presenting saved lives.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, actually, what – So I would like to have your problem where you're at grassroots and want to spread. So I'm at the national level, and we're looking at how we can reduce readmissions for post-stroke. Partnership for Patients, they're focusing on reducing readmissions and reducing acquired or adverse events. And so I thought, well, how do we do that? So we picked stroke, care transitions, out of hospital. And now we formed a learning collaborative of just people that are interested in the topic. And what we want to do is identify the right stakeholders that can help us identify the best practice. So if in Cincinnati they're doing this great tool, then we share it. We've engaged with CMS, and they have hospital engagement networks, and they're paid by CMS. But we're going to give them these tools once we catalog all the existing best practice tools, and then we'll give them to the we kind of want to look at it as a research thing, but they don't want to research. Mm-hmm. So anyway, if we just do the Minnesota Hospital Engage Network, give them these tools, the network is actually tracking who puts what into place. And so by 2013, if the readmission rate goes down due to, you know, the implementation of these tools, we should get some credit for that, or not credit, but you know, we'll see that this worked, and they will tell us which tools they put in place. So you might go to your higher medical level or your system or your state or, you know, but, you know, it takes time, coordinating, staff, buy-in. So the learning collaborative concept is excellent. It's just like what we're doing here. So that's kind of how we're going to do post-stroke care transition.
We're involved in that network, too. In Maryland through Premier. So Premier is one of the vendors for the Hospital Engagement Network. So, but I find it interesting as you're talking, both readmissions and adverse events or hospital acquired conditions are all outcome measures. And so, again, I think those outcome measures, hospitals can glean a lot of information, good information to improve patient care. Through those outcome measures. So I go back to my, let's get on the bandwagon for outcome measures being our e-measures versus process measures.
Hi, this is John Song, Albuquerque Coalition for Healthcare Quality, and I've got a question for the group based on this last discussion. How is it that you choose the right stakeholders? I think that term was used. And I assume right has something to do with the not only knowledge, but also the energy of the people that are participating in that type of collaborative. And then how do you herd them to a directed outcome? To me, that seems like a really important part of this whole thing, something that would be good to document and spread nationally.
This is Mary Thompson from CINA. My head is spinning with all the thoughts from the early morning keynote to today. And I want to just bring it up a little bit and maybe simplify it. It might be too simplified, but to speak to the caller's question is that I see NQF's responsibility coming out of this today is to formulate the how do you do this? How do you bring the learning collaboratives together? How do you get the hospital networks together? How do you include the vendors? And you take it to each of the specialty practices and the primary care providers, and you say, you pick one. You pick the Coumadin. What is the one measure that you need to develop out of your society with all of these stakeholders participating in this and not jump with both feet? Take that time over, let's say, the next year and get all the lessons learned from the processes. It's kind of like in quality from Japan, where they take the 75% of a budget and spend it on the planning piece so that when they're ready to go with all the rest of the measures that we have to get to at some point, they have the right formula. But I see NQF as the one that provides the guidance, the direction, and the goals for what it is they want to come out of this, and possibly even coordinating some of the funding that would support the work. But I see the societies who have so much of the knowledge experts, and then the community hospital has a tie-in to CMS through that network, maybe those groups coming together under the guidance of NQF to come out with at least the first round with some, because we are, I mean, it just, there's, I did a whole lot of PQRS submission work, just got through that phase from the vendor side, and some of the things that they ask the hospitals to do or the providers to do is just, it's outrageous to think that they would be going to the trouble of trying to document all that. They don't have the time. So if we can get them to do a simple metric for each of the specialty practices in the primary care and take those lessons learned and then expand on that and roll it out. It's like when I turned in my draft document in college, I got the grade I deserved. But when I took time to build on those drafts and turned in the final one, which was number 8, I got the A that I wanted.
It's a great analogy, actually. And when we think about what we're charged with today and the whole issue as far as, you know, some best practices for data analytics, I think what's fascinating is that there are standards out there right now, but there's more standards that are needed, right? So the whole idea of leading off on good analogies, there was a good analogy this morning. And our first speaker was talking about we've gone from a data desert to now a watershed, right? We've got a lot of great water, but it's murky. And we need to focus on purity and nutrition, right? And so the idea of being able to start to reevaluate what exactly we can do nutritionally for our patients as a result of those data, right? And I think that's what Dr. Mostashari was focusing on today when he talked about Coumadin, is getting our eyes on the prize. And so when we think about getting our eye on the prize here, what do we want NQF to be telling HHS as far as what should we be focusing in on? We've already talked about the measures, simplifying the measures, focusing in on doing the best we can with just a few, those measures that are actually going to impact, right, patients, impact care in the best possible way. Then we also have talked about some issues as far as engaging physicians and having the physician really engaged in this entire process, which I think is important, because when we talk about getting individuals around changing a culture and changing the way of doing things, that's going to be one of the things that's talked about in the other rooms. So the other breakouts, we're talking about acute and ambulatory, and I know workflow was a big part of it, right? What kind of workflow changes had to occur to ensure that the data was captured? And I think if you put some of the prize first, right? What's the low-hanging fruit? What's the prize we're after? I think that our ability to actually go ahead and change workflow and make the adjustments that are needed is going to be a lot easier as well. Hey, we're getting pretty good here as far as filling up some slides. So as far as opportunities, best, what would you like? What else should we be? Yeah.
I have a lot of ideas, I'm sorry.
Excellent. Glad you're here.
So I think the MedPAC spoke to Congress a year ago, and shared decision-making is becoming bigger and bigger. But it's the way I see the most important part of that is a risk-benefit explanation to the patient. So Coumadin, here's your risks, here's your benefits, and as a patient and family, tell me what your preferences are, what your value is. Can you come in once a week, or even every morning at 8 o'clock for an IR check until we get you stabilized. And then, you know, capturing the decision of the patient. But so you have to engage the patient more. So NQF needs to approach it like, or we need more, and maybe Pete Corey is going to help do this, get at that. But we're a measure developer and have a guideline group, and our guidelines won't do the risk-benefit. I mean, we're working with them to get risk-benefit stuff outlaid in there. It's a big safety issue. And then not everything has to be risk-benefit explained. It's just when there's a lot of controversy or patient preferences or sensitive issues where they have to make a difficult decision. And then capturing the decision is critical because then the physician's activating them, but they may decide, I absolutely don't want that. And so you don't want the physician to be, or you want that information so that other people can reach out to that those people and say, I know you don't want to do this, but this is in your best health. Otherwise, you're going to end up, you know, whatever. So
this is John Song. On that point, let me also throw in that capturing the reasons patients make decisions, I think, is critical and something that's overlooked because you can't talk to them as a population if you're talking about addressing these non-compliance issues in a population way unless you understand the main reasons that the patients are non-compliant or that they're resistant to treatment recommendations that are evidence-based.
This has been an interesting discussion. I just have a couple questions. They may be out of context or a couple observations related to opportunities. I'm sure you discussed, you know, leveraging structured data that are out there already and standardizing, using that and standardizing the workflow. Or I'm sure there are some best practices related to workflow and capture of the data. So I just throw that out to the panel. I was in one of the other sessions, and they were talking a little bit about leveraging structured data that's out there, structured terminology, the quality data model, and obviously some challenges with that as it relates to workflow. So it's just a question, because I'm sure that really comes up in clinical data analytics, capturing as part of the workflow and what's structured and what's not structured and how do you leverage. It's probably even more important to leverage what's not structured because it certainly is very critical in terms of outcomes.
So this is Ted, and let me give you two examples from our experience in Colorado. One is we did a small pilot and then took that information and information in the literature to extrapolate to all, if we could control all our uncontrolled hypertensives. So that seems easy because it's discrete data, right? Because, I mean, we still have the definition of whether they're hypertensive or not, but once you've got that done, there's discrete data. We know whether they're on meds or not. Extrapolating that if we could control our uncontrolled population of hypertensives, that the number needed to treat to prevent one major cardiovascular event was 10 patients. The number needed to treat to prevent one cardiovascular-related death was 50 patients. There's an outcome measure. We've seen that rate control over 15 years is true, in not only in Kaiser data, in anybody's data, that we can prevent that. There is a, is that potentially a low-hanging fruit? We may not meet all of that because we have patient non-compliance issues, but people don't want to be treated. They don't want to monitor the blood pressure. We know that there's a subset that aren't going to do that. But again, there's a huge number in that out of control group. That what if we could bring them into control? There's a true patient outcome using discrete e-metrics. The other one relates to, well, what about one that's a little bit harder? And this is the example of how we had to try to define our congestive heart failure patients. We had ejection fraction data. Guess where most of that ejection fraction data is hidden? in the dictation reports from ECHOES, from Nuclear Med, from, you know, those are where. So what about having the ability to standardize on that LOINC for laboratory measurement, that LOINC code, to say, we're going to get all those EFs into a e-metric measure of, we're going to have LOINC-coded EFs. We're going to know whether they come from Nuclear Med scans, echoes, and now we can start defining that superset of congestive heart failure potential patients. There's another outcome, because we know we intervene sooner, we keep them out of the hospital. We know we intervene sooner, we keep them from having CHF exacerbations.
I just wanted to comment briefly on the cycle of information and its impact. You talked about the number of patients that are needed to have an impact, and then you still have this resistant group. I find that I am resistant when I don't want to do things until the physician gives me the data that I need to hear what I have to do. So you have another measure that you take a look at this resistive population when given the facts of the impact of the change in behavior, what it can have on their lives, what then is their compliance rate? How does that change? And it just, I think it spirals down, but that's taking a really simple piece of information and following it through and learning from the whole process to then go on to the more complicated measures. I just loved what you said to me. It triggers the ability to use the data over and over and over again in different ways.
Yeah, then you get to measure it to see if you actually reduced cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
So, and you know, that's the outcome we're all looking for here. And Donna's point about measuring outcomes, that's got to be, we got to keep our eye on the ball. That's where we want. We want better outcomes. It's going to lower cost. That's a no-brainer. So a lot of the stuff we're doing is for cost. We're not stupid. We understand it. All the redundancies and the ordering, getting patients on ACE inhibitors with an EF less than 40, or get an AICD if it's less than 30, or whatever it is. There's a lot of basic medicine that really is unknown because we don't have the data out there. So, and we're not measuring concurrently and giving the physicians and the patients the opportunity to say, oops, maybe we ought to do that. We get more decision support from the gas pump than we do from IT in our healthcare system.
So I want to make a comment, Rosemary, back to your question. Some of the discussion we've had here in this group as well is that, again, yes, I've got a faulty mic here. Structured data will often exist out there in terms of for a measurement driving towards an outcome, but one of the challenges is that it's not necessarily the data that is needed is not necessarily resides in one place. So even within, one hospital system, there may be multiple systems where that data needs to be pulled from, and sometimes that there are, challenges and complexities around that, so that we're experiencing, and then particularly outside of the hospital walls, but across the care continuum as well.
So in just quickly in response to that, the data may be coming from multiple systems, and there may be at varying levels of granularity in terms of the attributes about the data. So that's probably a gap area. If you have multiple providers putting the same code in, but some are putting attributes around or a greater level of detail, for instance, a condition or a diagnosis, whether it's active or inactive, and then you get into some gaps in terms of interpreting it because it's multiple providers at different levels of granularity. But then again, that's where the standards could help in terms of the point of care entry to help it make it easier from a data analytics perspective.
And I think that really becomes important from not from beyond an episode of care, but looking at for population health management and outcomes. That's going to be huge. It's very
provider
huge.
Adoption too, because the docs want to see the impact. I'm telling you right now, that's how we've had success. I show them their data. You ask her. I go right to their meeting. You're doing a great job, transparency of it. Within the medical staff, they drive each other to be the best performers. So that's what we do for a living.
So Joe Francis with VA, we're the guys that did that Coumadin measure, which Farzad mentioned, which, by the way, is a measure that I don't recommend to be a performance measure. because if you're managing an individual patient, you need the INR. We have calculated a time and therapeutic range aggregate for our sites of care. It's not a physician-specific measure because we don't let physicians prescribe warfarin. Physicians decide when warfarin is needed, and then our pharmacy teams adjust the dose. And we're actually using the time and therapeutic ratio to actually look at what is it that makes a Coumadin clinic effective, because you just don't wave a wand and say, poof, here's a Coumadin clinic, and, you know, that's a structural measure, by the way, and they do a good job. There are factors, how the team works, what the patient population is, whether or not you use point of care or at-home testing and self-management. These are very complex, and we figure measures like that are quite helpful. But I don't want to use those, you know, in front of the doctor to manage the individual patient, and I don't want to use those to report up to CMS what my quality is for value-based payment modification. So that gets, I wanted to use that as an entry to talk about one of the first slides y'all showed, which was the definition from Joint Commission about clinical analytics, which I think is a little lacking and probably reflects the fact that Joint Commission is focused on one thing. So there's lots of, you know, analytics encompasses lots of things, including prognostication on the patient level, which, again, I wouldn't use as a performance measure, but that data may help you decide what drug to use. Or, frankly, what is the risk of this patient dying in the next year? And, gosh, maybe I need to have more intensive services for them. Or it can be used to look across your system to say, you know, what are the structural features that make the most sense? It's, you know, business intelligence is a multifaceted piece, and I feel like we get hung up on how do you rack and stack and, you know, reward or punish people based on their category of performance, which if that's the way we're going to go, I don't think we have strong enough measurement systems to create fair and durable comparisons. And then the other part, I would have to leave the room for a conference call. I don't know if people have also talked about the value of public reporting of performance and sharing that information. Patients don't look at it now for a variety of reasons. We've been trying to put a lot more of our, actually a lot more complicated clinical analytic data on the web, and it's interesting the conversations that it starts, even among people that don't fully understand it. Sometimes the conversations are with Congress or the media, which are not always fun. But it gets people to think about the delivery of care in a way that's more than just sort of one-off, I did or I did not lower the cholesterol, or I did not prescribe the beta blocker. And that, I think, is what we should be able to do in an EHR-enabled environment. It doesn't mean I can press a button and get an answer, but have much better conversations. And that, to me, is the value of a true analytic approach.
I think your comments point out just how powerful data is, and there's so many ways that we can be using it. And whether it's concurrent abstraction so that we can get the data immediately and make changes right then and there, versus choosing data that's going to really empower the physician to be able to make those choices and not have to worry about, well, this data is going to be only used for reporting, right? So when we think about our time today and we look at some of the things that we've discussed, we've come up with some great ideas. I think probably most of us in the room also feel like maybe the train has left the station and we're all running to get caught up to the train, right, in the sense that we have stage two meaningful use that's before us. There's a lot of measures there. We've uncovered that maybe we need to start focusing on some low-hanging fruit. We're saying let's maybe slow down at the same time as the train seems to be speeding up. So when we think about maybe short-term, mid-term, and long-term recommendations that we can make around all of this, I think there's an opportunity maybe for us to bring up some immediate ideas that HHS might want to know about for stage two. Then there's also the midterm,
and then there's long-term. And I was wondering if we might be able to think about looking at our recommendations in that view.
Has the VA had success stories for such a robust system with such a defined population?
Good question. I think that we can... The problem with the success stories is that you can never really figure out what is it that led to the success. Like,
about cost.
Lots of things happen in a complex ecosystem. We deployed an electronic health record starting in the mid-90s, and lots of things happen. But, other things happen. We couldn't deliver primary care under law until the mid-90s. That made a huge difference. We changed our internal reimbursement system to essentially what's a global capitation rate for our facilities. That made a huge difference in terms of where you put the emphasis. We had lots of really, really smart people in our health services shop, very similar to Kaiser, that could actually look at the data and, do deeper dives. What we haven't done essentially is either a stepped wedge or a randomized controlled trial to say, did these things actually contribute? But having said that, we're 100% electronic. Our biggest problem right now is if the system goes down, we're in big trouble. And we worry a lot about that because no system is 100% reliable. We're starting to actually now see, I think we have second generation problems and everybody else is struggling with the first generation problems of EHR implementation. Our second generation problem is information overload. We have so many clinical reminders. My wife, who's full-time primary care, says it's death by 1,000 clicks. We now have connectivity with patients 24/7 and secure messaging and, frankly, standards for providers about how quickly those messages get answered, particularly if it's like, a suicide ideation. And that means, you're never away from work. And that's something that we're sort of struggling again to deal with the burnout. I'm finding something very interesting. We tend to talk in these venues about, what's the life like for the docs. My shop does patient satisfaction measurement, and we're doing some analytics looking at our drivers of low satisfaction in the hospital, and a lot of it is centered around people not sensing that the nurses are spending enough time with them. And I, when I walk on the wards, I just say, I feel like it's because they're feeding the machine. And that's not getting into the issue. Like, we do collect electronically data on hospital-acquired pressure ulcers. But we have three or four different systems, depending on where you are in the hospital, and we force nurses to enter the same data into structured fields in triplicate. And we do that for the purposes of measurement. But it's, what do I want my folks to do? So I say our successes, which were probably early, which are the same ones everybody else see, it only lays the pathway for new failures, modes, and more interesting things that we have to struggle with. And for us, I think the key is the point that the gentleman from the electrophysiology group made this morning, which is, user acceptability, user testing, integration into flow. And how can we actually capture data without people having to constantly type or turn their face and back away from the patients? So that's for us is how we're struggling. And actually, we're doing so now with the Department of Defense because our next generation health record will be done conjointly with them.
We on here. On the slide deck we showed this morning or this afternoon, slide 28, if we could go to that one for everybody on the web. So this slide is getting at what you're talking about, is how do we enhance that workflow so that the nurse can spend more time with the patient, that the doc can spend more time with the patient, with anybody in the healthcare pathway of providing care can spend more time with the patient and less time hitting checkbox, radio circles, typing, drop-down lists, and all that stuff. I am not here to say I've got the answer to that. This is a complex human-computer interface problem to solve. And there needs to be human-computer interface experts in understanding how to do this. Some other systems have solved it. Well, not solved it, have made progress towards helping solve it. Maybe we need to bring people in from other fields to understand how this works.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, I mean, we did some early data on transmission of meds and utilization of the PC, but again, I think if I throw a bone out there for the vendors, one thing I would love to see would be a time-in, time-out period for staff that would have some relevance to how long are they actually on the box and how long are they, you know, functionally using the box, or is it idle, or, you know, those kind of metrics I've always had a challenge of achieving and seeing, because everybody says they're there, but computer time goes pretty quick. So, our nurses, we actually have done some studies with human engineers to look at them and totally objective to healthcare to watch our nurses and staff, and it's driving some of our multidisciplinary rounding processes, which is good, but it would be nice if the computer could somehow capture those analytics so we could use it to say, hey, you know, why is this unit spending so much more time in there? Maybe that's fault of the system. Versus the nurse. Maybe she can't get to the right database. Maybe she can't get to the right medication that she needs to utilize.
So, an interesting, before this meeting, I was just at Epic headquarters in Wisconsin. I was on the Research Advisory Council and the Physician Advisory Council meetings. So I sat in a presentation, and I think it was Ohio State. Don't quote me on that, because there were so many presentations, they're all kind of who did what. But they did a time motion study looking at that very issue on their normal workflow and an enhanced workflow that not only captured the data they needed for looking at immunizations, did a time motion study, 30 seconds difference between doing it the way the patient still got the immunization but didn't capture any data versus capturing the data and plus getting the patient an immunization, a 30-second difference. Now, you'd say, well, you know, 30-second over 500,000 patients or whatever, that's a big deal. But those are the kind of studies that help us understand, okay, can we cut off another 10, 15 seconds from the workflow by having some computer interface analysis of that? The other presentation I listened to was, And this goes to the next slide down, I think. I don't know where it is. Anyway, it's talking about the future here. So now imagine yourself in a land far away where we've solved this initial problem of defining the e-metrics and capturing them. Everybody's heard since the mid-90s evidence-based medicine. There's a new term now, evidence-generating medicine. Have you heard that term?
No.
So it's using the e-metrics captured to actually generate the evidence. So instead of having to do randomized controlled trials, which we know are getting longer, more expensive, more time-consuming, it's not going to do away with that. But how do we use e-measures to actually produce the evidence that we need for the next phase of improving healthcare? I bring that up to say, you know, we need to solve this first issue. But think about the potential. It's a quantum leap then.
So you're talking about concurrent studies, getting rid of our retrospective studies and being able to actually doing management while you're actually studying. That's just...
Yeah.
It's out there, but it's there.
I just wanted to chime in on the amount of time that it takes away from direct care to input some of this data. And one of the solutions that we've heard about to this is an iPad app to where you collect the data right at the bedside. So you're kind of hitting two birds with one stone with that. And, I mean, proliferation of technology, I think we'll have all the devices probably before we have the apps or software to be able to do that, but that's a possibility.
I think that's a great comment. where are the app developers in this? They're not even regulated, some of them. I mean, FDA has just started talking about that. Do we want to create another layer of bureaucracy on this? I don't know. But are apps even collecting the data in a way we need it, you know? I mean, that's huge.
We do that. We have a device that managers, actually we do it for our hand hygiene observations, and they have this handheld device that you can drop and it won't break and all this kind of thing. But it's a concurrent tool so that it's even got alerts in it that you can alert the manager if you do five observations in a day, and the manager then is alerted and she can gather the group together at the end of the day and huddle around and say, guys, we've got to do a better job with this hand hygiene. We also use it for, and it's unit specific. So, and it's quite nifty and easy to use. And you can ask as many questions as you want, but we usually focus on the who questions around the hand hygiene. But it's also used for patient satisfaction rounding. So it's really where it's at, I think.
I'd like to put a challenge out there in terms, and a little bit of fun to some of this in terms of that whole usability piece, because I think that is really key to the long-term success of this. Is you've got medical schools, you've got informatics schools combined with them. Set a challenge out there. Remember last year when they challenged the group to see who could break into the polling booth? And they really put, I mean, the pedal to the metal on that, and came up with some really clever ideas. So you get the medical schools, the health information technology groups together in teams and come up with some of the principles for usability that can be shared across all of the vendor groups. Or you even throw the vendors in with it, too. But you get something going out there that will stimulate creative notions, not just having, you've got all these different vendors trying to figure it out before each other instead of just throwing it out into the public domain. And challenge the students who are learning. The med students are using these tools, and I'm sure they're very frustrated with them as well. So they would have that notion. So I just thought it'd be kind of fun to make a recommendation to have some fun with it.
I think actually ONC might have done something like that with a Facebook challenge. Create something for Facebook. ONC might have done it. I think it was reported at HIMSS. I don't know.
It was like a MySpace.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but it's great. I mean, there's great thinking out there, and, you know, it is going to take everybody to bring their talents together to make this happen.
I think coming from this group, the point that usability is so critical, that's the message that this group maybe needs to deliver, is that's going to be central to the success of all of this, is if you make it difficult for the providers to put the data in, you can have all the best metrics out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still not going to capture the data the way you need it to be captured.
Going back to, Rosemary?
You know, in listening to you talk, coming from the other group, there's an opportunity. You're really changing the value proposition in many respects about getting this data into the system. It takes a little bit of time, but if I, as a clinician, am getting real-time feedback on the quality measure for the time that I spent putting the data in, and if I'm getting evidence to generate new healthcare or new measures, then maybe that kind of changes the playing field, because it's no longer an EHR where I'm just putting the data in. It's my quality, my evidence-based management tool, because I'm getting real-time feedback. Just an observation.
Well, it's more than an observation. It works. With Dilaudid, there's only one way you can order Dilaudid at our hospital. Only one way. And it's always decision supported because it was that big a problem. So every provider who orders Dilaudid gets that pop-up and that message telling them that equivalent dose. And it worked. We proved it with clinical analytics. We did a benchmark, and then we proved the effectiveness of it, showing a reduction in Narcan, shifting of dosing from a 4 milligram down to a 1 milligram, and we saw much less narcotic-based ADR. So it does work, and I don't think that's just pie in the sky. And I would love to see the VA data. I would love to play with your data. I think, you know, I'm so fascinated with behavior of providers that. Right, right. Good, perfect. So they fixed that. They took Demerol, Dilaudid, and got rid of the D's. not a bad idea, and actually we're considering that in some cases. So, but that.
Buy a computer.
Sometimes the performance measure is not nearly as efficient as having the right team or the right, you know, guardrails in place. Again, you know, I don't know that it's the time and therapeutic ratio that improve warfare. We have the flexibility for a variety of reasons, including a certain degree of protection from local licensure vagaries, to optimize the use of all our practitioners, nurses, APNs, pharmacists, social workers. And, you know, in fact, I think cognitive load is probably the biggest impact on, you know, you're talking cognitive load when you're dealing with the emergency room. And so if the computer can assist, I think the computer is basically a communication tool. I had a life-changing event when I read the book by James Gleick called The Information, because he made it clear that, you know, we're not talking about silicon chips here, and you know, an information system can be African drummers, but it's about communicating appropriately end to end so that you transmit meaning and you minimize noise. And we saw that, you know, the improvements that happened with telegraph, with telephony. No one was ever asking for a return on investment when telephones were introduced into patient care or paging, because you knew you needed communication mechanisms. And I think the electronic health record is fundamentally a communication tool, and it works internally with the team so that everybody can see what the plan of care is, everybody can see the radiology results. And I think the real payoff is when it works across systems. You know, the other part where I say I honestly don't know how good we are is a good portion of our care happens outside of the walls of VA, because we have veterans that have Medicare, TRICARE, commercial, and the EMS system may take them to your hospital when they're having a heart attack. And, you know, honestly, unless they tell me when they come back to me and I type it in my text note what you did to them, I don't know yet. So our eyes are really on the prize of this health information exchange, and then I think we have real analytic capability.
Actually, we have a hard stop. I hate to break us apart, but unfortunately, they have to tear this room back down and make it one big room. So, Rosemary, did you want to say something before we close out?
Well, it's probably a question that may take too long to answer, but in terms of scrubbing and analyzing the data and recommendations for going forward, if there were three, what would be the top three key recommendations? Maybe this will help you with the report out, too.
Can I add one more thing?
Mostly that was just jocular saying, go ahead. It wasn't important.
Well, so I think that what's the national quality strategy is missing is the care delivery value chain, so it actually gets right at what he just said on the information, the communication, operationalizing to get rid of the noise, but it goes all the way to the end. So Porter does a lot of work in the care value chain, and we have it mapped out for stroke here with Teesberg's work in the United Kingdom, but they actually look all the way across the continuum, and if the record systems could think like that, like, oh, this activates this team. I mean, this is a lot of clinical decision support, but then you know that, oh, I'm on alert, I do this, and I know it passes here, and et cetera. So mapping the value chain, and none in the national quality strategy, there was no mention of the required skills across that, and it's all episode of care.
for this episode, but what the patient cares about is their long-term continuity. So I think some real important takeaways are communicating across these different teams, taking care of these people. And then the other thing is risk factors. So we don't really capture risk factors at every changing moment when the patient goes into another risk factor area. So I think if we could capture that somehow, that would help a lot.
So this has been great conversation, but as Karen mentioned, we do have a hard stop at 2:00. We will be, so thank you everyone. We really appreciate your conversation and your attendance at this session. So what's going to happen here, first of all, to the folks on the phone, you'll need to hang up and exit out of the presentation and come back in for the 2:30. We will reconvene at 2:30. Please take all of your things with you because they will be reconfiguring and reopening up the room. So again, thank you everyone. And Karen will be doing the presentation or the report out for the group. So if you have anything else you wanted to include, just make sure you talk to her at the break. Thanks.